101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. I love this song. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
Boy, we were off last week. There was a Kid Rock special. What did he do, 8 concerts?
He's still got 2 left.
2 left. All
yeah,
right.
ZZ Top.
Rock it out. Yeah, what a ZZ Top is an opening act. Oh, my God. That's
yeah.
incredible. If you're listening to this on podcast, which will be available at noon on Monday, you didn't hear the song that preceded our the beginning of our show, which was Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. What's that about?
You know, that's a good question. There's so many times, I played these songs so many times
yeah.
repeatedly, and I don't know what half of them are about. I just jam out.
Well, you know, it occurred to me, oftentimes all we know are the hook.
Yes, exactly.
I want to take you there, and there was a book, something like called, He Has the Whole World in His Pants. I think that's one of them.
Oh, and it's about lyrics.
Misunderstanding
yeah.
lyrics. Yeah. yeah.
Well,
and
we
another
all do
one,
it.
Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy.
Yeah.
Instead of
right.
Excuse Me While
kiss
I Kiss
the sky.
This Guy.
Right.
Yeah. Whoa, what's up here? Everybody wants to call in to 313-298-WRIF, which is?
313-298-9743.
And if the reason that you are wondering why we're giving out these phone numbers, it's not a contest. This is WRIF's phone-in talk show. I'm Peter Werby. Julene Jordan with me as always, and we want to get your opinion on what's going on in the world, and I'm wondering what everybody's on about. Usually you wait, and so you don't have to either. Call in right now, say, I want to talk about so-and-so. We've got stuff we want to talk about, but we welcome your remarks as well. You go to my website, see some of the stuff we're going to talk about. Peter Werby, WERBE.com, although that's 20th century. 21st century is Facebook.
Or a Facebook page, yeah.
Yeah, Facebook page at Night Call or Facebook.
Facebook.com/Night Call/Night Call.
Doesn't she do that so much better than I do? Anyway.
We each have our own strengths and weaknesses,
yes.
Peter.
Also 20th century, but we still use it. Email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Your comments there as well. Well, how horrifying what's going on in Egypt.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really tough to read, even read about, let alone see the images.
And now, too, the security forces, the Egyptian security forces, acting at the behest of the Egyptian generals who overthrew the elected government of President Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood, and was beginning to install an Islamic government. So people didn't like that, and they really rose up in the millions to say, no, we don't want a religious mm-hmm. government. We want a secular government. And I think most people involved in that effort, the secularists and people like that, actually who are called the Coptic, C-O-P-T-I-C, the Coptic Christians also supported that because there's a bad history of attacks by militant Muslims on the Christians in Egypt. So they were pleased that the Islamist government was thrown out. However, who in the world expected this massacre carried out by these generals? Now, the United States attempted to broker a compromise. This isn't too well known. And the detail, I'm not going to go into the details, but you can kind of look for it yourself if you're interested. But the generals, the government, now, who essentially overthrew in a coup the elected government of Egypt, said no compromise. They arrested. Now, what's the basis for that? One of the things you might be able to say, we wouldn't think that in our country. Millions of people, as they did, came out and protested against George W. Bush and his illegal and unfounded wars. Or a lot of people don't like Barack Obama. We wouldn't force him out of office, and if for some reason or other, well, I guess Bush did, carried out such heinous policies.
Yes, he did.
And as far as I'm concerned, I think Jalene as well, stole the election of 2000
yeah.
and 2004, he would not be imprisoned, even though maybe, well, all right, let's not go there. But that's what's happened. The elected president of Egypt.
A lot of people have called for him to, take
exactly.
him to The Hague.
Yeah, where the International Court is. But this President Morsi of Egypt, he is imprisoned by this military government. So it sounds a lot like what began before Arab Spring and all that incredible hope and power to the people, as we use at the beginning of our show, and it's all now come to this. And it's just another massacre yesterday, apparently, or because they're a few hours behind it. Maybe even today, 36 unarmed prisoners being held by the security forces were killed inside of this bus. They shot them. They sent tear gas into this bus and choked people to death. So I think there's a great tendency to think, you know, these horrible people, they're so uncivilized and all that. I mean, I do wonder how people can do that kind of thing. I mean, huge mobs of people have attacked the Islamists. They were trapped in this mosque, and as they were coming out, they were set upon by these. And I'm wondering, who are they? I mean, are they secularists? Usually you associate that kind of behavior with religious fervor.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
For sure.
Yeah. And millions of people wanted the overthrow of this religious government of President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, but I don't know if they all expected this. And what does this mean? What does this portend for the country?
Yeah, where does it go?
I mean, they're almost at a civil war now. Now, the Islamists have responded by burning down Christian churches.
A good old religion, Peter.
Yeah, good old religion. Give me that old time religion.
We can always count on a good old, you know, bunch of war and heinous acts in the name of religion.
And it's not unique. I mean, if you can imagine Buddhist mobs attacking Muslims in, like, Myanmar, in former Burma, and
that,
all of that.
That's a mind blower right there.
Same thing happens in India. The Hindus attacking Muslims, and in some cases Muslims attacking. But it's not, it's not just them. There was almost 150 years of warfare in Europe between 1517 and 1648, which was the Protestant Reformation and these religious wars. And it's still going on in Northern Ireland.
I know. It's unbelievable that still to this day.
Yeah. Now, to be sure, it is not just about religion, although that's sort of oftentimes the fervor that's whipped up. It's often about nationalism. It's about control. It's about the money. What a surprise, right?
Yeah, really.
So I don't know. I mean, it's just amazing. One of the things, of course, that the military was fearful of in Egypt is that the racket that they ran, I mean, the incredible power and wealth controlled by the military would get shunted aside. And this, like, probably a multiplicity of reasons why they did what they did. But that was a big one. Many armies across the world are essentially these financial rackets. And some cases.
Wow, even ours, Peter? No.
No, you know what ours are. But let me get, but, you know, for instance, in Cuba, where I've been a few times, the army owned the bus fleets that we rode on, and the army owned the hotels in which we stayed. I'm thinking, how can an army own, in a communist country, own buses? I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
They're run well. People always say,
everything's old, though. Aren't they really old?
No. Not these tourist buses.
Oh, the tour buses were new.
These were these big old, those things with the big, huge windows and that. Yeah, they're Chinese buses.
That surprises me.
Yeah. And and the hotels, some of them, like these all-inclusives, because in Cuba, one of the things that they depend upon for foreign exchange is the tourist industry. So if when you go to places like these resorts, I mean, mostly the people that go there are probably Canadian, and they don't care, Cuba, Dominican Republic, wherever.
It doesn't matter.
Where's the best deal?
Right.
And some of them who we talk to never leave the compound. They're just there for a week or 2 weeks.
Man, I would be exploring.
Yeah. I mean, Cuba's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know what that tells us. In this country, I wouldn't say that the military is a racket. What is a racket, of course?
Are you kidding?
Is the military-industrial complex.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
A little more specific. I get it.
Because, and do I have that, or is that maybe up on the screen? I can do most of
what
it from
it?
Memory. The United States, well, let's put that a little more specifically. We, because this really means you and I and everyone listening.
We pay for it.
We're paying Egypt, $1.3 billion a year. In the scheme of things, you would think, well, it's not a lot, but kind of over about 10 years adds up to a considerable amount.
$1.3 billion a year.
Yeah.
To me, I was astounded by that number.
Yeah, and I think over 30 years, which we've been doing, it's about $30 billion. We could use that. We could use that pretty
well. We could use that in just a couple places around
town. Now, here's what it's used for. Now, how did these Egyptian troops and security forces, where did they get the wherewithal to shoot down their own people, these tanks, these sniper rifles, and what have you? Hey, guess what? They got them with the money that we sent them. We, you and me. Instead of sending it to Detroit, instead of sending it to Southgate, and Oak Park, and all these other cities around that are having financial difficulties, it went to the Egyptian military, and this was under this horrible dictator, too, Mubarak, who was overthrown.
Remember him?
Yeah, remember him? To suppress his own people. And here's what happened. So you and I pay taxes. I've talked about this formulation before. So there's a wealth transfer. You and I pay taxes. And what we expect from that is schools,
services,
roads, first responders, police and fire, EMS, and all that, right? Instead, this music, hello, that's a Freudian sleep, I mean slip, this money, in this case, $1.3 billion of it is sent over to Egypt, and what they do with it is they use it to purchase arms from domestic, from U.S. arms makers, from all the helicopter companies and the fighter jets and all the small arms and all that.
Another familiar theme, and it's that we have our dirty little hands in everything.
Yeah. So essentially what we're doing is that you and I are granting corporate, we're the financiers of corporate welfare for all these big aerospace companies and Raytheon and small arms manufacturers and all that. Isn't that sweet? So that's a racket. As far as I'm concerned. What do you think?
Sure is.
313-298-WRIF. Well, let's do this. So usually I got a lot more to say, but this sounds pretty interesting. By the way, if you call 313-298-WRIF, you reach Jefferson, he will get you on the air after getting a little bit of information. And
don't chew his ear off. Yeah. Save it for us.
Save it for us. Just say, I want to talk about Egypt. I thought this was important to talk about, and I didn't think people are going to respond too much to it, but
yeah.
We have a couple people all ready to talk about
it.
Well,
good.
Somebody named Anonymous. Oh, no, it's Anonymous. That's right. Let's get him or her on the air. 313-298-WRIF for more comments.
I'd be ready for that button when someone wants to be anonymous.
Yeah, hi, Anonymous. Nervous. You're on the air.
Is this me?
Yeah.
It's you.
Well, actually, I didn't protocol myself as Anonymous. You can call me Seabass Boss. And I completely agree with everything you're saying. And I think it's the fact that we defy our moral benevolency as a people. And I'll tell you what happens in Egypt is that people just aren't people anymore. We become the animalistic behavior that we can't even circumvent, dude. And I think that you're speaking the truth. And I'd love to hear you more, and if I could be in the backdrop, man, with you.
Well, how did
everyone
you...
Everyone wants to come in and be on the show.
How did you happen to
honest
be in...
To God, honest to God, because I don't want to get my head... Because I was actually been in Egypt, and I've...
How did you happen to be in Egypt?
Yeah.
How did you happen to be in Egypt?
Because I served called America.
Wait, but, you cut out there. What was the last part?
The military?
Because absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. My whole family served this military, and that's what's beautiful about it. But, I see no – it's not like I'm an old man or anything like that. I'm 34 years old.
Wow.
But the first thing I did, because of my good grandfather who served World War II, he was the reason that I served for this military and for a good – what you would think is a good cause. But the destruction of humanity is absolutely distinct, and it's a moral benevolency, and what you're talking about is the truth, and I can't, and if you want to bring another caller up,
Well, let me do that.
He's like, we were looking for a producer, right, Peter? Just kidding.
Well, here.
Now, I have a question, though. Do you have regrets? You have regrets about being part of
this? You want me to do the radio voice and all that, but I'm just...
No, your radio voice is just fine. I'm just asking you if you have any regrets.
Not one for fighting for this beautiful land.
Okay. But let me do this. You listen on the radio because we got to, you know, get one person on at a time. So I appreciate your call. You know, by the way, and Anonymous was talking about, what did he say? People were like animals. Most animals do not commit mass murder.
That is so true.
I wonder who are the human beings that get up on a rooftop and shoot into crowds and can justify that somehow in their mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And who do they pick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think there's really any rhyme nor reason to
and
that.
It goes back a long time. I mean, since the political state arose, it's been getting more and more vicious, probably culminating the worst during World War II, of course. But if you think about the Crusades, here's another place where religion didn't exactly live up to the supposed morality of it. The Crusades, when the Crusades conquered Constantinople and when they conquered Jerusalem, they just slaughtered everybody. In Jerusalem, they killed the Crusaders from Europe, came in there and killed like 30,000 Muslims. By hand. They didn't have any Apache attack helicopters or Bradley fighting vehicles or...
Now, that's real war right there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, these guys were absolutely crazy, and they were doing it because somehow they felt that they were inspired by the word of the Lord. I mean, this is pretty sick.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that supposed to be good and doing good for people and doing unto others and all of that and... I agree with Anonymous. There is an animalistic sense in all of us. I think that's part of, you know, the people's desire to watch violence or watch violent movies and things like that. That's the inner animal in us. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, I like to watch violent movies.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. I mean, I'm an animal, but.
Well, we all are. You are an animal. Here's somebody good. I don't know whether they're challenging us or not. It's Frank just driving through Michigan. Frank, thanks for calling. What are the numbers you want to fact check?
You know, I don't remember if I was reading what newspaper I was reading. Could have been the USA Today. Could have been the Wall Street Journal. I think it was more like 1.6 billion is what we're giving them, with 1.3 going to the Egyptian military itself.
Actually,
Did I misread something?
No. Actually, you're right. Sorry, I was just talking about the military aid. There's little bits of. Let me see. Egypt also receives, at a minimum cost as delivery charges, secondhand U.S. equipment under the excess defense articles, which is worth hundreds of millions of dollars annually. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars, $250,000 in economic support funds. That's it. $2 million annually for the international military education and training. So, but it's $1.3 billion in outright grants for the military.
Now, do we give them weapons also on the side, like airplanes?
Well, as I said, they get our used stuff.
That's just unbelievable to me, especially with me moving to Detroit so my wife could attend medical school, which I'm dreading, but I'm doing it for her, coming from Siesta Key, Sarasota, Florida.
Hey, listen, you will fall in love with this city. Trust me on this.
Yeah.
I moved to Miami, and guess what? I came back.
Yeah, you know what? I don't like Miami either. Don't
You're a tough one to please.
But look, Frank, welcome to Detroit. And I think particularly, you know, that whole culture around the medical school and the area around Wayne State University where she's going and downtown. The city itself, obviously, it's in bankruptcy. There's intense problems.
But is there a cool arts and culture scene here.
And as soon as you leave kind of the downtown area and that sort of central corridor and all that, it gets pretty sad that there's been a real collapse of city services. As you know, the city's in bankruptcy and all of that. But I'm sure where you're going to live and the experiences you're going to have, you're going to be telling people to come visit you.
You really will.
Frank, come on.
I remember,
down.
You know, when I moved here, 1998, all those years ago, and people were like, what? You're going where? And they still don't understand, but they see my passion and they're curious.
Yeah, the sophisticated weapon systems already purchased by Egypt, with more in the pipeline, include F-16 fighter planes, E-2C Hawkeye reconnaissance aircraft, Apache and Sikorsky helicopters, C-130 transport, Sidewinder, Sparrow, improved Hawk and Hellfire missiles, M1A1 Abrams and M60A1 battle tanks, and M113A2 armored personnel carriers. All of these weapons have either been delivered or in the process of being delivered. Here's the names. And some of the U.S. major defense contractors, including Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Electric, Boeing, Sikorsky, General Dynamics, United Defense, and Raytheon, among others, that wind up with these contracts.
The usual suspects.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. Not you, but I'll ask you this, too. But call us. You can call us at 313-298-WRIF. Why in the world would we be arming all of these nations like that, and at the same time hoping they never use them? Do we think that Egypt is going to fight Iran? I don't think so.
Right.
In fact, Iran was happy that they got rid of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're fearful
of
a movement like that in their country.
And because we send them all of this, just last week, as of Friday, the death toll was around 1,000,
yeah.
4,000 injured. I'm ashamed.
And Jillian, you and I have been to a lot of demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, reproductive rights demonstrations,
sure,
against these horrible trade pacts that hurt the U.S. workers so much and all of that. If you knew you had a good chance to be shot down, well, and I'm not really kind of throwing this at you, because I don't know what I would do. They said, okay, if you remember, we were in, speaking of Miami, we were at that big demonstration in Miami. As it was, the cops just kicked the crap out of people.
Well, they gave us a pretty good spray, I recall.
Yeah.
It took a few days to recover from that one.
But if we knew that there was a good chance they were going to shoot into our crowd, would we go there?
Probably.
Probably we would, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to say I will. And I don't want to say...
Don't disappoint me, Wordy.
Well, no, I know. I mean, you can go to a demonstration and get killed? That's tough. All right, let's get some more calls. 313-298-WRF. Here's John in Burton. John, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I was kind of curious about if you remember why the Brotherhood really hates us.
Why it what?
Hits us?
The Brotherhood hates us.
Oh, America. Hates us. Yeah,
America.
Remember
in World War II, let's say, for instance, Russia and China was not a ill nation at the time, and China and Russia took over and actually helped win World War II. What would we have to have right now? Instead of Israel having a bunch of Jews in it, maybe it might be Michigan. I tell you what.
Let's go back to the J word.
Let's go back to the J word.
Wait. First off, let me tell you. Yeah. The Soviet Union essentially won the war in Europe, without a doubt. I mean, do you notice that the Wehrmacht suffered, and someone can fact check me on this, that I think the Wehrmacht, the German army, I think suffered 90% of its casualties on the Eastern Front.
Really?
And that the United States and Britain, what have you, inflicted about 10%. And, well, because they were out of there until D-Day in 1944, and when was it, 41, I guess it was, that they were fighting, the Germans were fighting the Russians for 3 years before that, and it was the Soviets that really did them in. Somehow, when you start talking about Jews, I want to say goodbye. So goodbye, John.
If you use it in the right context.
I didn't even get it. It just didn't sound right.
It didn't sound kosher.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe that there are still people that are going to go there.
They're everywhere.
Are they still?
Yeah.
I
think so, Peter. Mostly directed at African American people, Muslims, but.
They still, but do you think they still think that the Jews control everything and all that?
Yeah, the entertainment industry?
Well, People tend to concentrate on in certain industries. So what?
Who cares?
Yeah. They've been doing a good job. Didn't they kind of put together movies and all that?
Kind
I like
of,
that.
Kind
beginning
of
the 1920s
yeah,
or earlier.
Yeah.
Here's one of our favorite callers, Maurice from Detroit. You're on early, Maurice. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter, Julie. How you doing?
Good. Hi, Maurice.
Do you ever, give a second thought of why this country has so many bases, military bases around the world?
Yeah,
and
like 800,
so
right?
Money on arms.
Well, yeah, that's one of the reasons. That
you think maybe they know something that we don't know? Because see, like, the way they spend the money, they're waiting to fight a big war. If you look at what they spend more money on the military than the other countries spend.
Yeah,
sure.
Well, it's just, it's big business, as we were talking about the military-industrial complex, and so they're all in it to make all of this money and line the pockets of the big companies that make all the munitions.
Sure, and one of the things that Obama just did in response, he canceled these military exercises with the Egyptian military. So I had two thoughts about that. Why are we over here having military exercises with this country way over there? I mean, we've armed them to the teeth, and I don't know who their enemies could be. You know, even though that they're pals with Israel, and not pals so much, but they've had this peace treaty and they get along, mm-hmm. and the United States counts on Egypt for being one of the pillars of stability. Well, that's gone. In the Middle East and peace with Israel and all of that. But now that they've armed Egypt to the teeth, who do you think that they might have a war with? They've already had two with Israel, and now they're better armed than they ever were.
Yes, they are.
And the second thing is, when we have military exercises, and see the flag flying in all over the world, our heart beats faster and all that. You know what I think? How much is this costing us?
Too much.
How come Detroit is going bankrupt? But the federal government has enough of our tax money that they're going to have military exercises with the Egyptian army over, where would they be having it? The Mediterranean or I don't know. Suez Canal and all that?
You know, one of those really highfalutin planes could pay to bail out this city.
Yeah.
One.
Okay, let's do that. Maurice, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Some open lines for you. In fact, I want to talk about solar panels. They're going up on the White House again.
Again?
Yeah.
That's
after
amazing.
Reagan took them down.
Yeah.
These Republicans. All right. We'll be right back if you want to continue this discussion about Egypt, okay, or some of the other things that are going on. Also, I'm talking in a little while about the Justice Department is going to stop these incredibly horrible, stiff drug sentences. That's very important. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you by your authorized Dodge dealer. Experience a world of performance, design, and fuel efficiency. Schedule a test drive. Go to Dodge.com and check out their powerful lineup.
Look out in the street there. You know what you don't see? My car. Because I had to sell it to pay the lawyer I hired when I got busted for drunk driving. Know what else you don't see? My girlfriend, who decided that a guy with no car and no license and no money was no fun.
Cops are out there cracking down on drunk driving all across the country. And they'll see you before you see them. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 83113.
Okay, everybody, so Jim's going to take us all through the company's plans for marketing, sales, and manufacturing before we break for lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Growth.
Great presentation, Jim. Lunch, everybody.
Lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings. Amazing burgers, deliciously hot wings, and great sports. That's the lunch you can't wait to get to. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Take your lunch into overtime with our bottomless, boneless lunch. Order all the boneless wings and fries you can eat. Weekdays now through August 30th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Dine in only at participating locations.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hi, thank you very much. We've been talking about Egypt, and surprisingly, a lot of people have been calling in because what can we really express other than the horror that is going on there? Certainly the country going in this direction of having an Islamist government, any religious government, I would say, is absolutely awful. And whether it would be Muslim or Christian or Hindu.
No matter
or,
what.
Yeah, right. They're intolerant, all of them. Let's see. Winston Smith writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Your question of what kind of people would shoot into crowds from rooftops, because the Egyptian security had snipers on the roof just shooting into these crowds of Morsi supporters, the deposed president of Egypt. He said, do you doubt that our increasingly militaristic police would be morally constrained from doing that? You know, I have to say, and some of you police officers that are listening may find this sad that I say this, but I don't think so. When you get an order, hey, you know, you got to do it. And he's right. The increasing militarization with the kind of weaponry, and we remember we were talking
equipment in general.
Yeah, the last time we were on the air about what's your favorite police officer that was pepper spraying all those college students?
Oh, Lieutenant Pike.
Lieutenant Pike. And what I said, that nobody seemed to mention it in the background. Here were these college students. They all looked like they were in their late teens or early 20s. They were wearing, some were wearing shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah.
They were all battle-ready, and some of them had automatic rifles. These were for...
Now, wait, who are you talking about?
The police.
Okay, because that sentence...
that
was a poorly structured sentence, yes. Which you rarely do.
Yeah, the kids did not bring their,
no.
Their fully automatic.
All they had were their apple cider vinegar-covered bandanas, which is what you use when you get pepper sprayed. Just a little FYI for you there budding you. Protesters out there.
He said,
there.
If you do, remember Waco. Okay, I said I was going to talk about White House
panels.
But I wanted to get this caller on the air. It's Dennis from China Township. Hey, Dennis, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Dennis.
Oh, hey, what's up?
Nothing. You. Go ahead. Come on.
I don't know if it's true or not, but I was seeing some things that some of my friends posted on Facebook that Oprah said something about... All white people are racist, even if they don't use the N-word?
I don't know what it was exactly that she said, but this stems from something where she was in Switzerland. She was trying to look at a very expensive handbag. If anyone can fill us in, because my computer is being a dinosaur on that, we need to look into it.
What's your interest in the subject?
Oh, well, it just seems kind of like, I don't know, bull crap to me, because I hear about, like, you know, like the Imus guy or whatever said nappy headed hoes right. About a basketball
Don
team.
Imus, remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, that's ancient history, yeah.
Got
well,
shut off the air for a while, and all the sponsorships taken away.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty nasty-ass thing for him to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's
go with
we get some people telling us whether that was
vocabulary.
The case or not. If she said that, I don't know. I'll tell you, a lot of people that are outside of the mainstream because of a characteristic, because of skin color or religion or sexual preference.
Yeah.
Often think that everybody of the larger group that has discriminated against them for a long time historically still holds those. I remember reading some Jewish writer who said, even in the warmest Gentile heart, there's a cold spot for the Jews.
Ooh.
Now, I don't think that's true. at all. But the sense, because of the role that, and not now, and although Jalene's right, there still are a lot of anti-Semitic people around, yeah. It wasn't in full force the way it was, say, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. So there is that perception of people that are on the outside, that looking in and think that the mainstream group, or the, what would you call it, the dominant society, all holds the same view. So if she said that, she's wrong, and it was dumb. But she didn't say it on the air the way Imus did.
She called it a racist moment when a clerk refused to show her a handbag that cost more than some new cars. She called it a racist moment.
I think it's a repulsive, classist moment that she could afford, anybody can afford handbags that cost more than cars people are starving all across the world.
I know. I can't even imagine a few $100 on a handbag. That's ridiculous.
You know what I don't get? I suppose you got to be in a particular stratosphere that... why people don't buy knockoffs. I know, maybe I'm going to get in trouble saying this, no?
All you got to do is go down to Canal Street in New York, you can have whatever you want.
I mean, why pay $8,000 for a Rolex when you can get one for $40?
I know.
That looks the same. You can say, well, they wear out. Yeah, but you can probably get
another one.
in the last 2 years. What the hell? I never understood that.
I don't get it at all either.
Yeah. Here's Anthony in Macomb County. Thanks for calling us, and thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
We're good.
Hey, I want to let you know, man, we need our military. If you've never been there or never been in it, we really need our military. I'm a former Navy SEAL, and now I do civilian work out of the country.
Do you think we need 800 bases all across the world?
I don't know about 800 bases, but we do need to show a presence.
Why do we need to show a presence anywhere other than our country? Nobody else does. Nobody else has bases. China doesn't have bases. Russia doesn't have bases. Canada doesn't have bases.
You know what a presidential mandate is?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. If we go to war on our own soil. See, we've never gone to war on our own soil yet. We've had some planes crash into us. That's about it.
There was Pearl Harbor, too.
Yeah, well, Pearl Harbor was to Hawaii. We're talking about an island. I'm talking about the mainland, our mainland.
Actually, Los Angeles had caught a couple of bombs from a Japanese submarine.
Yeah.
But the point being, one of the reasons that people are ticked off at us is because we're in their face all over the world. Let me put it this way. What if we found out that China had a North American command and was going to do like war games and military exercises with Cuba or Venezuela or Nicaragua or something like that? And we're the only country in the world that has all that, and this creates more the possibility of wars and attacks. I mean, why do you think that people don't like the United States?
Well, the countries I've been into, they think we're all multimillionaires. And I've told people when I was out of country, I was like, people save their money for years and years to go on this type of vacation. They blame a lot of, when I was in Greece, they blamed like 90% of the crap on the United States. And I was like, you know what, a lot of people work there. They work and they save their money to come here.
Well, some do. Yeah, indeed. But the point I'm getting at is if we didn't have these bases all around the world, if we weren't sending drones everywhere, if we weren't starting wars, most of them based on lies around the world, I doubt whether people would dislike us quite as much as they do now.
Well, we do need to stay out of some things, but we can't be the police of the world. And I understand where you're coming from there.
Yeah.
But we need to show a presence in some countries, and that's all there is to it.
Why?
Like what I do. I'm paid well for what I do when I go out of country.
Well, very few other countries go out of country. But
now, this is you're being paid by... the taxpayers.
No, this
right?
is a private contractor.
I'm paid by the United States.
Private contractor now. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people from the military.
There's big money in that. That's why they go over there.
All right, Anthony, we agree the United States should not be the policeman of the world, so let's leave it at that. Thank you very much. Here is Jay in Southgate. Jay, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, what's up, brother?
Just you. Go ahead.
Not a whole lot. I was just wanting to comment on this racial thing that this other cat was talking about.
Yeah,
yeah, what's up, dude?
I personally think it's just a thing of ignorance. And, you know, people are who they are. I'll call it like I see it, you know. If I got to get a reaction using certain phrases or what have you, I'll use them.
Are you talking about like the word?
The word, the N word, cracker, apple.
What is there to gain at all by using the N word?
I'm making a point on if these people portray them certain traits.
You are stereotyping.
I don't think this is going anywhere.
It's going nowhere. But
later
Danny
on, Jay, let's get to the solar panels.
Now, and I would say maybe try a different approach to make your point.
Yeah. Now, everybody says, all the news accounts say that there were these solar panels put up on the roof of the White House by Jimmy Carter in 1979. And here I'm looking at this article. It said the panels came down in 1986 at President Reagan's request. And so that's like 7 years.
Why would you take them down?
Well, one of the things, why were they put up? Is because of the oil embargo, the 70s, and all of that. And Jimmy Carter understood that there was going to be a problem with foreign fossil fuel sources. But this is really a mistake. The first thing that Reagan did when he hit the White House was to order those disconnected. They weren't taken down until 1986 because they did renovations.
Okay.
Well, fortunately, they're putting them back up now under President Obama, who realizes that this retrofit will at least give the signal of the necessity for doing
renewable energy.
Yeah, right. But unfortunately, I would say that it is just sort of a gesture. Let's see.
Well, there's a lot of that. Hey, Peter, can you hang up on that last? Okay, thank you.
Bill McKibben, who runs this organization called, what is it, 350? Is that right? 350.com?
Like
yeah, well, it would be good to know. You can go to. In 2010, Bill McKibben and a group of students from Unity College in Maine, this is where these panels wound up, took this road trip to Washington to return one of the Carter-era panels. They were working.
Still to this day.
From 86 to this day.
Cool.
To the White House and requested it be reinstalled, or at least the White House pledged to put up a few new panels. About half of the Carter panels have been installed on the roof of the cafeteria at Unity and this college, and they were working. Well, so we say, oh, isn't that nice? We are now starting to get renewable. Well, unfortunately, it's not the case. Michael T. Clare, who's written an article called How to Fry a Planet, says the energy industry is not investing in any significant way in renewables. Instead, it is pouring its historic profits into new fossil fuel projects, mainly involving the exploitation of what are called unconventional oil and gas reserves. And humanity is not entering a period that will be dominated by renewables. Instead, they're going to have what's called the third great carbon age. This is not going to work well for us.
Are you talking about things like fracking?
Hydrofracking, the use of high water pressure columns to shatter underground shale formations, the exploitation of carbon-dirty heavy oil and tar sands formation is accelerated in Canada, Venezuela, and elsewhere. And Michael Clare says, an ever-increasing share of that staggering investment in fossil fuels will be devoted to unconventional forms of oil and gas, Canadian tar sands, Venezuelan heavy, extra-heavy crude, shale, oil, and gas, Arctic and deep offshore energy deposits, and other hydrocarbons derived from the previously inaccessible reserves of energy. The explanation for this is simple enough. The world supply of conventional oil and gas fuels derived from easily accessible reservoirs and requiring a minimum of processing is rapidly disappearing. This was peak oil, right? We've reached the peak of oil. So, but they're not going to give up on this. With global demand for fossil fuels expected to rise by 26% between now and 2013, more and more of the world's energy supply will have to be provided by unconventional fuels. You know, I almost said fools.
Well, that was a good slip right there.
That is.
Meaningful.
Here's John in Detroit. John, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What's
great.
Up?
Great.
I was calling in about the Oprah Winfrey situation.
Yeah.
We're not even sure what it all happened other than she felt that she was being profiled.
Racially profiled.
Yeah.
Well, the situation at hand was she was in Switzerland, and she went to a store, and she wanted to purchase a bag. Wanted to look at a bag, and the salesperson didn't want to unlock the bag where it was in the case because the bag was extremely expensive.
Yeah, it was $38,000.
Yeah, $38,000. Well, you're talking $38,000 to a person who's a billionaire. That's like $38. So
that's true.
That's not expensive to her.
No.
The average working person, yeah, it's expensive, but that's not expensive to her. But the thing is, she wasn't recognized. And like I tell people about this situation, you have to, because I've been in the entertainment business. I've been around a lot of stars as far as going and traveling different places around the world with them. Your popularity in certain places in the world is up and down. So you might be popular in four or five continents where you have to have a massive security around and people and everybody know who you are. And then you can go to somewhere like she did. She went to Switzerland, and then it's just maybe one person there, the saleswoman, who probably she might never watch the Oprah Winfrey show. She yeah. might not have a clue of who you are, even though you are this global icon who's done so many things in the past 20, 30 years, has a magazine, has a TV show that has changed.
A TV network.
And a network. Not to mention that you're a billionaire, so you're like in like 1% of the population of the world.
Sure.
You know.
She's 1% of the, in the United States and in the world. But go ahead. What's the point, though?
But, so the thing is, she might have took offense because this is a woman. Now you have to understand. This is a woman who goes to different restaurants around the country, around the world, where she has her own silverware and plates and special things like she has there
right?
already. So when she comes to this her favorite restaurant, they have a specific table that they pull out for her and chairs for her and dishes for her. So when you're somebody in that echelon in that category, you're used to getting treated a certain way. So out of the 99 times that you get treated this way and then this one time happens, I look at it like it should have been kind of a humbling experience, like, wow, this one person really doesn't know who I am. I don't think that I wasn't there, so I can't say how the lady might have reacted. Maybe she probably felt a racist vibe from the woman because African-American woman coming into a store asking to look at a $38,000 handbag, she might have had maybe been a little bit snobbish towards her.
Which is unfortunate if it did happen.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are, right?
John, thanks for your opinion. Appreciate it. Let's go to Daniel. Daniel's in Pontiac. Go ahead, Daniel.
Wait a minute.
Wait.
What happened?
I'm thinking I'm going to be on the air.
You're on the air and you're live right now.
No, I'm not. I don't hear me on the air.
Well,
because you're talking. But trust us.
I'm going to start counting to three.
Trust
Daniel.
Us. Go.
One.
Okay.
Two.
My feelings on the war on Afghanistan and that stuff over there, bring the Americans back and make them countries glow for about 10 years.
Whoa. I agree with the first thing that you said. The second thing, you're talking like mass murder, man.
He's talking about...
glow, like nuke them.
Right? I know, the other N-word.
No.
Nuke them.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a horrible thought, Daniel. Keep it to yourself. Keep it to yourself. Even
some things...
if you think of it. You don't have to say everything you think.
You don't have to say everything you think.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Right. All right, bye.
Didn't you tell me that once? Or did I tell you that?
No, I don't know. Right. Now, Jim Hansen... James E. Hansen, who was this NAFTA guy, has really concerned about global warming. By the way, one of our Jefferson, who you can reach, this is the first stop to getting on the air, at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. We do have some open lines.
Yeah. One of the callers said we should keep things more local. Well, there's a way to do it.
We do keep things local. We talk about a lot of local stuff.
Yeah.
Some shows are more centered on what's going on.
But you can guarantee that it'll be kept local by you calling in. And if you want to talk about
bring something up.
Local, you bring it up. bankruptcy in Detroit.
Yeah, and we tried to get a guest on tonight, and he never called me back, Jerry Weil. And
this is
really cool. You probably saw it in one of the newspapers or on the television the other day, a bunch of for sale signs, sale tags showed up on all kinds of different statues around the city.
Saying for sale or everything
for sale,
must go.
Everything must go. Two for 50.
Yeah, playing off of this thing that the Detroit Institute of Arts holdings, these fabulous art treasures, could be Kevin Orr, the
And they just started popping up everywhere, and everyone was noticing that. And I have to there was a group of people, Jerry Lettet, Kobe Solomon, local artist, also was involved in that. So good work, you guys. We need some comic relief in this city.
Well, here it goes local again, back to this. James E. Hansen, this doesn't sound local, right? But it is, that he's concerned about global warming, and he thinks that continuing use of fossil fuels is going to absolutely destroy the environment, which, you know what? I hate to say it. I think he's right.
You think?
You think, yeah. And maybe we can talk about the details of it later. He said, I think the only hope we have of phasing down emissions and getting to the middle of the century with much lower level of fossil fuel emissions, which is what we will have to do if we want young people to have a future, we're going to have alternatives, and at this time, nuclear seems to be the best candidate.
Oh, God.
There's a film out, which fortunately did not show in Detroit, called Pandora's Promise, where all this group of about five environmentalists, people from Greenpeace, and all these people that changed their mind, and now they're saying, listen, perhaps nuclear power does have problems, but nothing compared to what the continuing use of fossil fuels are going to do. The problem is a couple of things. 3 Mile Island and Chernobyl and Fukushima. Fukushima, by the way, is putting millions of gallons of water into the Pacific Ocean that are laden with radioactive isotopes right now. It's a disaster, an absolutely ongoing disaster. So here's a technology that can afford no mistakes. What kind of human activity can have 100% with not any error? No room for error in this. And the other thing, the big thing. Now, I don't know. I actually have a copy of Pandora's Promise at home. Maybe I ought to look at it, because what I want to know, where are they going to put the nuclear waste that has to be kept for a quarter of a million years safely?
I can't even wrap my brain around
human
that.
Human beings, depending on how you...
Let alone transport it.
Yeah. I mean, we've only had, like, the nation state for, depending on how you count it, like 4,000 years. And we're talking about pretty primitive people. When we even go back to 10% of that, 25,000 years ago. This thing had to be kept 250,000 years in the future, what we have right now. Now, just on Tuesday, a federal appeals court ruled that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was flouting the law because it stopped working on a review of the proposed nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Nobody in Nevada wants it. None of the Republicans, none of the Democrats.
God, how long have we been talking about Yucca?
They've been doing this for a quarter of a century, trying to find out a permanent repository for these fuel rods that are building up all around our state, all around the other states, at Fermi 2. Imagine these maniacs want to build Fermi 3.
Third one.
They're never going to do it. It's never going to get there. Fermi 1, what happened to that? Oh, yeah, we almost lost Detroit, didn't we? But Davis-Bessie and all these other ones.
Mm-hmm.
And Yucca is on a volcanic ridge.
Yeah, and rather primitive living people who have this very wonderful life around there. They were going to destroy that along with it. Ugh.
Now, also...
But they didn't win. They didn't win that one.
What do you mean?
Yucca?
No. They're not putting anything
right
in there. But here, one of the things that the Brainiacs in Canada want to have, they have a proposed site for a nuclear waste repository on the banks of Lake Huron. There's a good one. Our sweet seas. If you're listening anywhere else in the country or in the world and haven't visited the Great Lakes, they really are. I mean, that's a great name for them. They're absolutely
beautiful.
Looks
like the ocean when you're looking out over
it. Yeah, yeah. And if any of you sail, you don't see any land if you start getting out there.
It's amazingly beautiful.
But there's going to be a town, we're not into Monday yet. There's going to be a town hall meeting in Detroit at Wayne State University tomorrow at 6:30 in Wayne State University's Keith Center Lecture Hall to deal with this proposal that this nuclear waste repository is going to be surrounded by Lake Huron on three sides and could be located just upstream from the main drinking water intake for southeast Michigan. If this radioactive material leaks, the drinking water for 40 million people could be contaminated.
Yeah, when I look at this map and see how close it is to Detroit.
We are in the hands of crazy people. Yeah. Absolutely crazy people. You know,
they're insane.
In Kincardine, where this nuclear power plant is, and I've been right near there, they have something called the Atomic Cafe.
That's kind of scary and ironic.
Yeah. So the Ottawa Power Generation officials say, oh, we can keep it safe for thousands of years. Well, you know what? Thousands of years isn't enough. It's got to be hundreds of thousands a year. Mm-hmm. All right. I'll let you dwell on that. Is that local enough? And come back and want to talk a little more.
And we have a couple callers.
Yeah, Abraham wants to talk about Egypt, and Randy wants to talk about Kwame Kilpatrick.
And you can talk about whatever you want.
He must know him because he's calling him by his first name.
Oh, there they go again.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
At Advance Auto Parts, summer heat can melt down your car battery faster than a snow cone on a hot dashboard. That's why at Advance, we test your battery for you. Free. Need a new one? We'll install it. Also free. No reason for you to get all hot and sweaty. Come to think of it, no reason to put a snow cone on your dashboard. But that's irrelevant. Fast, free battery installation only at Advance Auto Parts. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
Most vehicles, most locations. See store for details.
Life has phases, you know, like the newly married and ironically dressing like your parents' phase. That's why Esurance has online tools like Coverage Counselor. Helps you pick the right coverage for whatever phase you're in. Esurance, insurance for the modern world. Click or call.
Coverage Counselor highlights options to consider in choosing coverage, not available in all states.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Okay, everybody, so Jim's going to take us all through the company's plans for marketing, sales, and manufacturing before we break for lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Growth.
Great presentation, Jim. Lunch, everybody.
Lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings. Amazing burgers, deliciously hot wings, and great sports. That's the lunch you can't wait to get to. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Take your lunch into overtime with our bottomless, boneless lunch. Order all the boneless wings and fries you can eat. Weekdays now through August 30th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Dine-in only at participating locations.
This Friday, help Lady Jane's Haircuts for Men break the world record for most haircuts given in 12 hours. You'll even score a Lions jersey. Now that's wicked awesome. Be a part of the record and get your free haircut. Register now at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Carnival of Madness Tour, August 27th, featuring Shinedown and Papa Roach. Learn how you can win free tickets and more. Details at WRIF.com.
Peter and Julie, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. You can reach us at 313-298-WRIF and give your opinion on the air, numerically, that is.
313-298-9743.
You can also reach us by email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We're on Facebook. We'd like to have you along. Facebook.com/nightcall. My website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Bree writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com a rather long email, which I really can't read all of it, although it's very important. And she's talking about the Rachel Maddow show on the DIA with the idea that some of these, I don't actually believe this could really happen, sell off some of the art treasures. Mm. And the emergency management law And she talks about a lawsuit filed. Well, it's kind of long, but she talks about the emergency manager's insults to city workers, retirees, and residents, and calling them dumb, lazy, happy, and rich. Did you know that? That's what, I'm pleased when I don't remember people's names like that. Kevin Orr. Right.
Did he really say that?
And he actually apologized. But
oh, yeah.
Can you put this link on our...
What? Where is it?
From here? There's a link on... At calltalkyes@yahoo.com, NBCnews.com, and then a whole bunch of numbers.
Okay.
Okay.
And who sent this?
Bree.
Okay.
B-R-I.
Thank
you,
Bree.
I'll
get on it.
Appreciate it. Okay, let's go right back to our phones. A number of people are waiting.
Here's, I think it's probably Bri.
Bri?
Brian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Whatever.
Yes.
Could be Bree or Bri. Here's Abraham in Dearborn. Abraham, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, hi.
Hello.
Yeah. So I just wanted to share my opinion on the issue of what's going on in Egypt and the whole military support of the U.S. to Egypt.
Please do.
So, of course, there is a whole economic background to what's going on, as you guys were saying, with the profit for the military and equipment and whatnot. I think there's also another dimension to this. If you actually study the religion Islam in terms of, let's say, economy, there's actually a very interesting economical system behind that, which is based on gold and not based on, you know, like stocks or virtual money.
Based on what? Based on what? I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah, I thought you said gold.
Based on the gold ratio. Based on
gold.
Yeah, with gold.
Hey, all these right-wing conservatives in America, they're all about the gold standard. They'd be down with that.
Yeah, that's one thing. So in general, I mean, if there was to be an Islamic State, I think the biggest threat to the U.S. in terms of money would be that the economic system of the of a state based on Islam would actually prosper and show the world that there's actually a defect in the way the U.S. is trading at this time.
Well, a lot of it is, I mean, there's a number of Islamic states that we, when I mean we, you and I, support with our tax dollars, and Saudi Arabia, the Gulf Emirates, a number of these countries, Yemen, all these, they're pretty much Islamic states, and I don't know how they run their businesses or companies run too much different. It seems pretty similar to what goes on in the dominant states as well. I mean, one of the things that the world religions say, and I would say their adherents rarely, and I'm not talking about the individual, but the people that control finance or businesses in a particular country that adhere to any particular religion never meet up to the ethical standard that all religions put forth, that essentially, well, the golden rule. I mean, we know what that is, that he who has the gold rules, but that's not really what they mean. They mean do unto others as you have them other do unto you. And they always talk about charity. So these, you know, right-wing Christian billionaires, they're certainly not about charity. They're about trying to harm the poor and trying to make life more miserable for those that are less fortunate. Imagine this. These vile Koch brothers, some of the richest men in America, multi-billionaires, and they think that there should not be a minimum wage. That's one of these things, these free market things.
And they don't want it to be higher.
No, right. No, well, because they know it would be lower. Why in the world would they want that? You would think they would want something like Australia that has the highest minimum wage.
$18 bucks.
$16 an hour for fast food workers there. You would think, God, I got so much money. I would like other people not have to worry, not have to scrimp and save, not have to wonder whether I'm going to get a decent meal for my children or a pair of shoes or what have you. Instead, they're just trying to get themselves and their rich buddies more and more money. All right, Abraham, thank you very much. Appreciate you joining the show. You have a good evening. Here's Randy in Allen Park. Randy, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on Kwame. You know, it's like
Kwame. Relief. What's his last name?
So stupid.
Yeah, okay.
And I had of meeting.
I thought you lived in Allen Park.
Yeah, I do live in Allen.
So what's the big deal with you have such, you know, such
fervor, we don't even know what he's going to say yet.
For somebody who's in another city.
No, I work. I'm a local 1045 member. I work down at Cobo Hall.
Okay, there you go.
So I had the fortunate comic relief of meeting him several times and watched him morph from a thug into trying to be and present himself as a decent, respectable person. He knew he was going down in flames.
Well, it was actually the other way around. I mean, he seemed like a great young hope, and he really had a lot of support. And why in the world he would, I mean, the arrogance and, as you said, the stupidity. It really is. We could think that somebody that's in the public eye like that could carry out such blatant illegal acts when the city needed leadership that people could have some trust in. And, I mean, contrary, you got this one idiot that keeps posting on our Facebook pages, should know better, that actually used to be a phone screener on this show, that keeps saying that Kwame Kilpatrick stole millions from the city of Detroit. I don't think he stole anything directly. He was just getting payoffs from contractors and what have you.
He was just doing some shady biz.
But what really was needed was a person that could step up at a critical time. And his failure, his criminality, his corruptness, his arrogance is absolutely inexcusable for sure.
Let me tell you this. Number one, he came in with the intention, like his mother, on duping the city. I watched him morph. His vocabulary and his mannerism went from street thug to trying to be respectable. When I first met him, his vocabulary was so lacking, I went out of my way to be...
Well, you know what? You say you met him. I mean, I've certainly heard him while he was running for mayor and when he got in, and he always seemed articulate enough. And I don't know what you saw. Sometimes there are African-Americans who have two ways of speaking, and one formally, which they may do when they're in the world outside, and a different one when sometimes they're just...
And who cares?
And who cares? Yeah, I don't understand the importance of it. What it was just part of the collapse of the city that is generated by all sorts of forces. And
you guys, who cares how anyone talks?
Yeah.
I'm a little annoyed right now.
All right, Randy, bye. When she's annoyed, yeah. All right. Here's Jane. Jane, hi. Where are you calling from? Jane, you're on the air.
Oh, Jane from Highland.
Okay.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to state my opinion on the fossil fuels and the nuclear fuels.
Please do.
I tend to think along the lines of I think it's a lot of big corporate greed that's running the show.
Yeah.
We've had solar and thermal for so long, as it's not even funny. Why we're not doing that, number one, because it would be free. There'd be no money for all the big shots. But let's get to the nuclear and what we're going to do with all that waste. We're sending rockets out to Pluto. Certainly we could send the nuclear waste to Pluto or beyond.
Well, they've talked about this, and the fear is that...
God, I don't even want to go across the country, let alone out in outer space.
Yeah, what about some of these spaceships that
kapowed?
Yeah, that would be kind of disastrous. It might spread a lot of nuclear waste, maybe across the whole world. I mean, first off, here's what's got to happen. Every one of these plants has to be immediately dismantled. Well, stop functioning, and then dismantled. And what in the world? I mean, I have to say, Jane, you're offering some solution. I'm just pessimistic that there is any solution.
How about filtration? How about some sort of plant filtration or one of these brilliant engineers coming up with some sort of a master filter that would capture all of this stuff? And so even if it was have to be stored for 250,000 years, would be done so in a safer manner rather than putting it in barrels and dropping it at the bottom of the ocean for all the fish life to get cancers and stuff.
Sure, or what they're going to do is put it in these storage barrels and put it inside of this mountain out in Nevada, but it's on a volcanic cliff, so they're a little worried about that.
Just so they should be just a little worried.
Well, it's what I said earlier, Jane. These folks got us into this. They sold us this bill of goods. Remember that you were talking about profits from it. They said that nuclear power would be so cheap they wouldn't even use a meter, that they would probably just have some low fee. Sure, they're going to just really give us cheap power. I don't think so. But we don't need these nuclear power plants. They are just the worst boondoggle imaginable on the financial level. They have to be insured to the extent that the private insurers won't even touch it. It has to be done by the federal government, and they're a disaster, no matter how you cut it. All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate your call. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. You know, it's pretty interesting. I was talking to a neighbor of mine, and I don't know, how can I set this up? He sort of realized there was a gap, and I said, something, where were you? He said, oh, I was in prison for 20 years. And this is not my other friend who was
right.
In
I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah, no, this is a neighbor.
So now, wait a minute.
For drugs.
Okay, wait. So, wait. You knew him 20 years ago?
No, no.
And you said, where have you been, man?
No. I just met him.
Oh, God.
But in any event, what okay. I was getting at. So now I know two people that have done like 20 years in prison.
Yeah.
Because people want to change their consciousness.
Right.
And are some of these drugs harmful? Some, and particularly, if like anything, if you overdo it. You can have one cigarette a day. If you start having 20 or 40, you're in for probably a bad time.
Well, and, you know, the possibility of overdose. In fact, my friend's niece just overdosed from heroin.
Died?
3 days ago, yeah.
Oh, man.
Died.
Well, so we know all the drawbacks of every substance that people imbibe. Right? Whether it's liquor or food or...
And they're going to do it.
Yeah. And people are going to do it. Right. In countries where drug use and drug possession and drug sales is punishable by death, people still do it.
Wow.
I mean, would you do drugs if you knew you could get caught? You could be killed? At places like Iran and China, they do it like that. Well, some...
I'd say probably not.
Yeah. Probably not. But in a major shift in criminal justice policy, the Obama administration has moved to ease overcrowding in federal prisons, which is just awful, by ordering prosecutors to omit listing quantities of illegal substances in indictments for low-level drug cases. What this means is they can sidestep these federal laws that impose strict mandatory minimum sentences for drug-related offenses. What's produced with this, we were talking earlier about the military-industrial complex, is the prison-industrial complex. And it's always accompanied by hysteria. And there's been reefer madness and heroin madness and crack madness. And it's not to say that that the problems that have been generated by the illegality of them. I mean, if crack was legal, if heroin and cocaine were legal and you could just buy it cheaply and you blow your brains out or use it recreationally, do you think people would be doing all the things they've done over the last, well, in terms of crack and cocaine, in the last 20 years or so? And of course not. Why would they do that? I mean, it's to get money to have this little piece of, what is it? Animal, vegetable, or mineral? What is it?
It's
mineral?
Chemical.
It must be mineral, then, right?
Yeah.
Attorney General Eric Holder, in a speech at the American Bar Association's annual meeting in San Francisco this Monday, announced the new policy as one of the several steps intended to curb, all right, here you go, right, soaring taxpayer spending on prisons and help correct what he regards as unfairness in the justice system. I mean, a guy I know was selling cocaine to lawyers.
Yeah.
These are adults, right? He wound up getting 20 years in prison. The lawyers, they just continued snorting cocaine and found another guy
yeah,
to sell it
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
Right? And they're still doing their thing.
Yeah, when you weigh out the crimes and who should actually be in there and who shouldn't, you know, it's pretty clear.
Well, these are nonviolent crimes. These
yeah.
are crimes that are victimless. I mean, think about this. I mean, what is the difference between a liquor store which a certain percentage of people that buy at liquor stores are alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And those people, who do you think does more social damage? Alcoholics and people driving under the influence of alcohol in domestic violence, in traffic accidents,
yes,
in machine accidents, think of driving public transportation and all that.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably in a year and probably in a month they do more damage than anybody that's using heroin or crack. Of course, what it's like what happened in the 1920s with alcohol prohibition. You make something that's relatively inexpensive to produce and sell and make it very expensive and hard to get. And people say, whoa, yeah.
I want it.
I want it. And they also a criminal enterprise begins as well.
Yeah.
And they don't follow exactly all the same rules as your neighborhood shoe store does. Right?
No.
They might just kill off the
competition. They don't have regular meetings and such.
No. I learned something. Actually, there's a book, and then it was also a PBS documentary done by, who's the guy that does all the documentaries about Civil War?
Yeah, of course, when you ask me that,
yeah, right.
But I know who you're talking about.
Mixed drinks. People didn't used to drink mixed drinks at all. First off, mostly men drank. Women did not drink very much, say, in the 19th century.
That's no fun.
People used to drink a lot, like in colonial times. Actually, liquor and alcohol consumption has dropped since the late 18th century.
No kidding.
Yeah. But the people that drank, men drank in bars. Very frequently, in the bars themselves, the walls would be lined with urinals, so guys could just go take a whiz without, they didn't have to go to the men's room.
Like right there?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. What's,
weird.
What does Uncle Ted say? When in doubt, I whip it out.
Why must you quote him?
Got me a rock and roll band, yeah. But anyway, so when Prohibition came about and some of the hooch, as they called it, the illegal liquor, was so terrible that they actually started mixing it with different sodas and
because it was
and,
just so hardcore.
Yeah. It cut into it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And also women began drinking. In fact, during Prohibition.
And then all the fun began.
Yeah, right. Prohibition actually encouraged drinking. Because it was just the
wild. Yeah, it's just when you want to take it. It was like when I was a teenager and my mom.
I wondered what you were going to say.
Telling me, you know, not to do something. And, you know, Peter, you know, I'm still a little bit that way. You tell me not to do something. I want to do it way more.
Yeah, mostly it's like smoking cigarettes. It's like what grown-ups do. And so anyway, so actually alcohol consumption during the 1920s increased.
That's not surprising.
And then when they removed Prohibition, when there was an amendment to repeal that in Detroit, for instance, something like 100 independent brewers. I mean, there were so many beer makers. People were just sloshing it down, right?
You mean during Prohibition?
And after, too, because then they could have legal, they established legal, legal drinking establishments and also brewers.
Detroit can party.
Yeah. Detroit, yeah.
Still.
Ain't no party like a Detroit
That's
party.
Right.
Who's saying that?
Don't question it. Was it Jay Giles, wasn't it?
I don't know. Hey, folks, who did that? Who did that? No, wasn't that one of those, I don't know. Who did that? Ain't no party like a Detroit party. No, you know who
Kid
that
Rock.
Is?
Kid Rock.
No. It's,
God, we're so lame.
My friends.
Your friends?
Yeah.
MC5?
No. Come on.
What?
They with the... With Tino, the lead singer.
Howling Diablos.
The Howling Diablos.
I think they all say it.
But they do that thing, but sort of rappish, you know. Ain't no party like a Detroit party.
Yeah, I think Giles does that too.
Do they?
Yeah, right. Someone correct us. We've lost our minds.
The Howling Diablos, they have this song called Mr. Right. And one of the lines is, I may not be Mr. Right, but I'm Mr. Right now.
I love that.
I like that. All right. So the Justice Department, what they're going to do in the indictments, they're not going to. I don't believe this. Jefferson says he's pretty sure it was Kid Rock.
See, it is Kid Rock. Yeah. I was right.
Okay. What do I know?
Well, you know, Peter, you're old school.
I'm old school. That's right. So what they're going to do when they have these federal indictments for possession or sales, they're not going to put in the indictment how much is there. So you're going to have like a half ton of blow of cocaine, and they're not going to put it down there because these prisons are just jammed. And one of the problems, though, this is great for federal courts, but the vast majority of people are not in federal prisons, but they're in state prisons. He said, and this is Eric Holder, the Attorney General, he deplored the moral impact of the United States' high incarceration rate. Although it only has 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the prisoners. And he noted that in the speech. He also tried to preempt political controversy by painting his effort as following the lead of prison reform efforts in primarily conservative-led southern states. And they've been doing that. They've saying that states like Texas and Arkansas have been experimenting with finding ways to incarcerate fewer low-level drug offenders. And the answers have included reduced prison terms for them or diverting them into treatment programs, releasing elderly or well-behaved inmates early, and expanding job training and reentry programs.
I'm surprised this is even being talked about because of the largesse of the prison industrial complex and the money that they stand. Why don't they just build more prisons? That's what they
Yeah, yeah. The prison guards, naturally. They don't want shorter sentences or anything. And the feds, by the way, the feds, they don't have good time. You don't get paroled because you were an excellent prisoner. So there's some little saying or something, but if you get 20 years, you got to do it, right?
Yeah.
Unless you can get like this elderly offender release or compassionate, some of these guys are dying. They've been in there for so long, so they get compassionate release because of illness and all that. But it's crazy. What other country is like this? Well, it's like Iran. It's like China. And what business?
About North Korea.
Yeah, they don't do a lot of drugs there.
But I'm talking about the prison. They'll put you in prison, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, what we've said is I can't imagine that what we've suffered and what the American people have suffered, what the drain on our treasury for this stupid war on drugs has cost us and in the lives that it's ruined. And do drugs ruin people's lives? Yeah.
Yeah.
And as I said, alcohol ruins lives. Yeah. My father was a recovering alcoholic. I mean, it didn't ruin his life, but it could have if he hadn't taken charge of it. And I'll bet you every single person knows someone, most people even in their family, that have had people in their family with alcohol problems. Anybody in your family with an alcohol problem?
No. No one.
Yeah. Right. I don't drink anymore.
Yeah, or less.
Any more than I used to, yeah.
You're lightweight anyway, Peter.
Yeah, I am.
Cheap date.
Yeah, when we go to station functions, I'm her designated driver. We've talked about this on the air.
We've talked about it in the air, and the thing that you do...
is count your drinks.
You count my drinks.
Yeah.
And I remember the last time I got annoyed by it. And you're like, so, Jalene, how many of you had at this point? I go, 25, leave me alone.
No, I just wanted to know if you were going to tell me the truth. I knew exactly how many you had.
Because you count them. I can't hide anything from you, Peter.
And you say, well, wait a minute, man, you're across the room. I was like, am I on you? Yeah. Let's see. Now, Eric Holder, the Attorney General's speech March, this was to the Bar Association, threw a litany of statistics about incarceration in the United States. The American population has grown by about a third since 1980, he said, but its prison rate has increased by nearly 800%. At a federal level, more than 219,000 inmates are currently behind bars, nearly half are drug-related crimes. And the prisons are operating at nearly 40% above their official capacity.
Ugh.
This is horrible.
Yeah.
And the idea that somehow this is going to end by example, by punishment, that people are going to stop committing this obviously it has inversely proportional.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
Because what's happened, they go, okay, this low-level drug dealer got busted. Someone on the block says, hey, there's room for me.
Yep.
Right.
It's my corner now.
It's my corner now. All right, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Anything you'd like to talk about?
We have some open lines.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
All you ladies and gents out there enjoying the smooth sounds of the interwebs radio, Geico's got a special dedication to make. This one goes out to the inventors of the mouse. Because of you and your rodent-inspired design, people can click on over to Geico.com to pay their bills, manage their claims, and live lives of pure savings. Mouse Masters, you've clicked your way into our hearts for good. Enjoy this next song. It's going out to you. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Are you self-employed, stuck on COBRA, or did your health insurance rates just take a huge jump?
Listen to this.
I'm Josh Cush of J.P. Cush & Associates. You've seen the signs. And when I founded J.P. Cush & Associates, I promised myself that my customers would always get the best health coverage at the lowest rates. Call me now at 855-4-JP-CUSH before the rates go up even more.
That's 855-4-JP-CUSH to get a quote today.
That's 855-457-5874.
Or go to jpkush.com. J.P. Cush & Associates. 855-457-5874.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
101 WRIF.
Yeah.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, Ann. Welcome back. Let's see. Jerry writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Jolene was right. They all do it. Ain't no party like a Detroit party.
See?
But Peter was a bit more right, and he's got a link to johnsinclair.us. John Sinclair, one of the seminal figures in Detroit rock culture.
And his former wife, Lenny Sinclair, one of our guests coming up.
At 1 a.m. with his new book that she put together with poster artist Gary Grimshaw back from the Grandy Ballroom Day. So it's essentially the history of Detroit rock and roll, 1965 to 1975. This beautiful book, absolutely amazing. But let's see. But it was done by the Howling Diablos. I don't know if this is going to come up here. Let me see here.
I always love when you experiment on the air.
Yeah.
It thrills me.
In fact, the Howling Diablos, this is a column by John Sinclair called Howling Diablos. Ain't no party like a Detroit party.
You better be careful. Are you playing music?
Yeah, who knows what it's going to say?
Yeah. Peter, please.
Here, can you link that? It's on the...
Which one?
They Ain't No Party Like a Detroit Party.
The John Sinclair one?
Yeah.
Okay.
From Jerry. Okay. Let's see. Here, I'm going to see this, too. Oh, I can't really... it says, the answer to our power needs may be this, which it's called thorium energy. I have no idea what it is. But, Frank, I will check it out a little later. All right. So, here. This is good news. You can beg. I mean, one of the things about living in a liberal democracy is that people's rights are defended. So people were...
Kind of. Mostly.
I'm being sarcastic. Ironic here.
Okay.
A federal appeals court has ruled that Michigan's Depression-era law, so it's been around since the 30s, that criminalizes begging is unconstitutional because it violates free speech rights. The three-judge panel unanimously upheld this lower court decision against Grand Rapids police, who said they were wrong to arrest two homeless men in 2011 for asking for change. The court said between 2008 and 2011, 400 people were arrested or issued tickets for begging in Grand Rapids. Of those, 211 were sentenced to jail terms. So, isn't this a wonderful country? You are now okay to beg.
Well, isn't that just mighty
precious.
Nice?
Yeah.
Precious.
Yeah. One of the judges said Michigan's interest in preventing fraud, I guess that was it. If you didn't really need money and were begging for it. Yeah.
Who's going to go stand there?
Most people find it kind of irritating to be approached by beggars. I always find it embarrassing. A guy came up to me one time. He said, I don't want to lie to you. I'm a drunk. Give me a dollar.
I'd rather just go drink it. I don't care.
There's some places that, some cities, it could be like Berkeley and some other places on the East Coast that they can give panhandlers script that they paid for. In other words, say for a grocery store, and so it's $5. So if you give somebody that, they can redeem it for $5 at a store.
Oh, like a voucher.
A voucher, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And let's see. And two of the people that held this were Republicans appointed by George W. Bush. Okay. Two Detroiters seeking money on Wednesday afternoon welcomed the court's finding of a First Amendment right. Lonnie Gaines, 54. He said, I'm really not begging, who held a sign saying, homeless, please help, to corner Monroe and 375 Service Drive. Probably seen him. Gaines said, it's their free will to give him money. I'm not threatening anybody. I hold up my sign and they have a choice. Yeah, I've heard about beggars being kind of aggressive and what have you. But I usually have found that when you say no...
They still say bless you.
They still say bless you.
You know?
They always say bless you, yeah.
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 I don't know. You know, if I have it, I'll give them a buck. I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what? People who think that's bad, I mean, I don't know. My friend who lives in New York City, when I went there, he goes, Julene, if you give anyone one dime, I'm going to smack you upside the head. Of course, here I am. Here. Just can't help myself.
I mean, sometimes, like if we go downtown to eat, come outside and, you know, I mean, meals, restaurant meals are so expensive. I mean, if you're getting entrees for, say, $12 or $13, which is not very expensive at all, right?
No, it's not.
Okay. So then you have one beer, which is $5,
yeah.
Right? And then
how about an app?
Then you without even that.
Okay.
And then you have a cup of coffee. In some places, it's as much as $2.50 for a cup of coffee. I was just at a breakfast place today. I couldn't believe it. The coffee was $2.50 a cup.
That's a little outrageous.
Okay, but anyway,
I don't drink the stuff.
So now we're up to $20.50 for one person, and if I go there with my wife and I tip decently, so that's almost $50. For
yeah,
a meal.
Unless you have dinner with me, and I barely eat.
Yeah. It still costs the same.
Dinner for one.
Yeah, it still costs the same. So, if you're going to a little bit more upscale and the entrees are like 18 or 20 bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're up to 60 or 70. So can you imagine how humiliating that must be to beg for money?
I can't imagine. I can't. You
I
know?
Can't. I can't at all. At one point, when I used to write for the Metro Times 10, 12 years ago, a lot, the weekly paper here in Detroit, I was actually thinking of doing a story where I would go out on one of those freeways with a sign.
Yeah.
Saying, homeless, please help. But I kept thinking, gee, what if I ran into people I knew?
Because you can't go anywhere without someone knowing you.
Well, you're right.
It's true.
Yeah.
Walking down the street anywhere with you takes a little bit of time.
And I wonder what it would have been like. I mean, I still think I probably should have just swallowed whatever pride I had or something like that.
You should have.
And done it. Yeah, but I didn't. But so the point being, though, that maybe that's what the law was put in, because that would have been fraud, right? I would have been soliciting money for people from people on the basis that I needed the help when actually I didn't need the help.
So why do you think they did this?
Which?
The
original law? Overturned it?
Yes.
Well, I think it's good constitutional law. The people have the right of free speech. And what was it, Balzac, one of those French writers, he said, the law and its majesty is equal towards everybody, a rich man and a poor man. It is illegal for a rich man or a poor man to sleep under a bridge or to pick garbage.
Hey.
Of course, what do we know? That the rich man isn't going to be doing that.
Oh,
right?
Hell no.
Yeah, same thing here. So this is a lot of merchants, for instance, dislike the idea of having people soliciting or begging around their house, around their store, or panhandle.
Yeah, they chase them away.
There are these very kind-hearted people down in the Wayne State area, which if I say who it is, the people will know immediately that are familiar with it, so I won't. But they actually ask their customers not to give money to the people out there, because people, they're very generous, so then they wound up with all these people. It's like a gauntlet almost. You have to go through people saying, hey, I'm hungry, or I'll give you all these stories. I just need a dollar to blah, 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 blah. Oh, let me get back to the restaurant where you spend $50 on a relatively inexpensive meal. I mean, I know that's not inexpensive compared like a fast food place, but if you want to go
where you can get two burgers for a dollar.
Yeah, but you made me forget it again.
No.
All right. Oh, so I consider it like a tax.
What?
Like a city tax for the poor, or a part of the meal. In other words, I'm going
to
tip.
To help them.
Yeah. If it's, what did I say? If it was $50, God, yeah, if it turns out to be, well, I was thinking it would get up to about $40 and there's, so I would give a 20% tip, right, to the waitress,
yes,
and then I'd give a dollar to the guy outside who's begging.
Okay.
That's part of eating there. Right? If you go to Birmingham, Birminghamites and Birmingham establishments, but not my favorite place to eat, you're not going to find any beggars.
Well.
Yeah, right?
Why do you think that is, Peter?
I don't know. You would think they would go there. There's a lot more wealthy people, but they don't tend to be real generous.
No. And you know, no offense to Birmingham, but a lot of these people would just look down their noses at them. That's my opinion.
Yeah, well.
I grew up in a city just like it.
Well, anyway.
Not my thing.
So we're talking about this U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that unanimously upheld a lower court decision that said it was wrong to arrest homeless people or anybody for asking for change. Gordon King, 60, who lives in a shelter and held a similar cardboard sign at Larned in the 375 service drive, said the opinion, quote, will help people. The case arose after Grand Rapids police arrested two homeless men, James Speet and Ernest Sims, who sued the West Michigan City and the state with legal assistance from the American Civil Liberties Union. There they go.
Again. Oh, the ACLU.
That ACLU. Right. And in January 2011, Speet was arrested for begging in Grand Rapids. He held a sign saying, cold and hungry, God bless. While the police gave Speed an appearance ticket and he pleaded guilty to the charge, unable to pay the $200
fine.
He spent 4 days in jail. I suppose if you're homeless and cold and hungry, getting four hots in a cot.
Yeah, right.
Probably.
For three squares.
Three hots in a cot.
Yeah. I don't think they're getting any midnight snacks. a guess, yeah. Peter.
Or high tea.
Yeah, tea and crumpets. Yeah.
5 months later, police again arrested Speet, this time for holding a sign that said, need job, God bless, while standing between a sidewalk and a street. After Speet secured pro bono counsel, which means free, the prosecution dismissed the begging charge. One of the things, have I mentioned this before? There's a lot of laws that on the face of them are unconstitutional, but the police use to kind of roust people, keep people moving, don't want people to congregate, like loitering. And a lot of the wording of the loitering statutes is being in public with no apparent purpose.
I think it sounds like a great time.
You can't hang out.
You mean, what's up with that?
Yeah. And so the law is blatantly, any ordinance like that is blatantly unconstitutional. I mean, geez. And I want to get to the Dream Cruise in a second, too, because that has to do with
you are ADD.
I am just
city.
All
I,
over
look,
the place.
I can yeah. go right with
right,
you.
Right.
I'm with you.
Yeah. although I forgot by the end of that point.
God, Peter.
But the point being, without any apparent purpose. The cities want to protect those laws that they use if they need to get people off the streets or whatever. So if you challenge it, like constitutionally, they'll kick the charge. So if you get arrested for loitering, tell them you
challenge
want
it.
Challenge it. Yeah. All right. The Dream Cruise. Now, tell people what the Dream Cruise is.
Okay. The Dream Cruise is a big classic car cruise that happens every August up and down Woodward Avenue here in Detroit.
That goes from 8 Mile Road, you may have heard.
Not
of
actually in Detroit, but yeah.
Yeah, never. And
north.
And goes to Pontiac, 16 miles. And there's usually a million people watching this.
You come from all over the world.
However, at 9 o'clock, it's major shutdown. A million people watching
yeah,
this.
Yeah, people come from all over the world.
However, at 9 o'clock, it's major shutdown.
They oh, just yeah, shut they block down. It off. They say, get out. It's really kind of a cluster.
Yeah. Now, a couple years ago, friends of mine and I went to see a band. Friends of ours were playing in and it's on Saturdays always.
Yes.
On a Friday night where people are cruising already.
Yeah.
They shut everything
Big
down
time.
At 9 o'clock. We walk out of this little, I think it was a coffee house, even the beanery or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, the coffee beanery.
Yeah, coffee beanery. And suddenly there's Royal Oak police on motorcycles screaming at us, get off the streets!
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
I don't know how it was this year because I wasn't there.
I didn't see a minute of it.
I was there Friday night, but I left before they cut it off.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. Get off the streets. That's the end.
This is a cruise on the streets.
Yeah. do you know the Clash song, Know Your Rights?
Yeah.
All three of them, as they say. And then at the end, they're yelling, get off the streets. Get off the streets. And do you know what happened to me last year? Why one of the reasons why I didn't go back?
No, I do, but can I tell it?
You want to tell it?
You got in trouble.
I
You had a little, you can't have that booze on the streets, Peter Werby.
Yeah, I didn't want to go to it, just sort of hanging out.
Because so you drank your way through it?
I know people really like it a lot, so this is just my thing. I'm not being critical of anybody else that went there. And there's a lot of things to it. It's like a big, huge community party. And people begin sitting on Woodward in lawn chairs as early as the Monday before the Saturday.
Or even before, you know.
So, and they're talking to people. They're face-to-face. They're sitting there, sometimes hundred people on a corner of like 13 Mile Road and Woodward.
Yeah.
They're not watching television. They're interacting
outside
with human beings. So that's very cool. I'm all about that. And then there's a big party. So it's illegal in Royal Oak, maybe in most cities, to have open containers
except for
of
Vegas.
Alcohol. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, Vegas, you could just walk around.
Well, you know, actually, I got arrested in New York City, too, for an open container.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Well, at least it wasn't for peeing in the alley.
No, I was sitting on a park bench. We were playing handball outside.
Do we need to check you in? We need to get you a little help?
Yeah, well, and so we're sitting on this bench next to a restaurant, and we're drinking a can of beer, my friend of mine and I, out the next to this restaurant, where people are sitting like 5 feet from us drinking wine.
Yeah.
So these New York cops come up and they said, we got to give you a ticket for this. I said, what? He said, drink it in public. I said, what about these people? He said, they have a license.
Oh, yeah.
So,
no.
All right, fast forward.
How much was that one?
I don't remember. So, fast forward to
Royal
Oak.
Last year.
Yeah. So, I didn't even want to go. I kind of had it with 55 Chevys and all that. And after a while, I feel like I'm just watching traffic. And I know a lot of people like it. I'm not. That's just me. That's me.
No, it's all fun except for the abortion bus. Oh, they had an abortion.
They had an abortion bus.
They had the abortion semi this year and an abortion bus.
Tell people what that is.
Oh, this is this big, awful, these buses where they put pictures of giant aborted fetuses.
Nice.
For all for the kids' enjoyment.
Everyone's having fun.
Jerks.
Yeah. Anyway, so I went there, and these friends of ours had a big picnic basket. In fact, they said, come on, we got food, we got some wine, and we got beer and all that. So we get there, and my wife and I, and this other couple, they got lawn chairs. And you know,
they got the setup.
They had the setup, yeah, right by Catalpa and Woodward. Right?
Okay.
Okay, so you want some beer or wine? And so I open the cooler, and I pick up this bottle of wine.
I love this story.
And the woman says, hey, put it back. Here comes a cop. I put it back in. And this police officer said, I'm going to have to give you a ticket for alcohol in public. I said, I didn't even drink anything. She said, I'm sorry. You're going to have to tell it to the judge. And I said, come on. I didn't drink anything. I was just looking at it. It wasn't even open.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know whether it was open or not. I said that. And she said, I'm sorry, my sergeant is really putting pressure on us. I said, well, let me talk to him. And I can't do it. Here's the ticket. Anyway, so
wasn't it like a couple $100 for that sucker?
You're getting ahead of the story.
Okay.
So I go to Royal Oak Court, very nice judge, and he says, here's what I'm going to do. And there's, God, I mean, 100 people that got busted. People are telling me they were drinking, like, O'Doul's, non-alcoholic beer. They were three blocks in on their own lawn from Woodward and all this. So it's just a big cash cow for the Royal Oak Police. Any Royal Oak Police officers listening or from these other cities,
well,
let me know.
I had a drink last year myself, but I'm...
From your flask?
No, my friends had a little thing going on. I got done working. I went down there. But see, I didn't get caught.
No, I know. So the judge says, I'm going to give all of you a break. I know you were just having a good time. This is a great event, the Dream Cruise and all that. And so I'm going to let you plead guilty to something like attempted alcohol in public, and it won't go on your record.
Attempted alcohol.
Yeah, so it won't go on your record. And the bad news is, he says, though, it's going to cost you $175. $175 effing dollars. So everybody's pleading guilty, and it's just going bam, 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 bam. So they're bringing us up in threes. So there's. He says, how do you plead? You know, not guilty, guilty. And he says to me, how do you plead? I said, I'd like to make a motion to dismiss. And he says, you do?
So
he says,
you
have a motion? And I said, yeah. He said, make it. And I said, look, I got this ticket, and there's no evidence here at all. There's no physical evidence. There was no evidence that there was alcohol in the bottle. There was no evidence that the bottle was open. In fact, there's no evidence of anything. He said, you know, that's really a good argument. I said, really? I said, will you dismiss it? He said, no, that's a defense. I'm going to bind you over for trial. What a smart guy.
He wasn't having it.
No. So, and I said, well, I want to change my plea. And he said, I'm not going to let you plead guilty if you think you're not guilty. I said, let me think about it a second. I said, I rethought it.
Literally a second. Long.
Yeah. So I just paid it like the rest of the people.
Ah, the good old cruise.
Oh, man. I mean.
You're a very bad boy.
What can I tell you?
You're a rabble rouser.
Anybody else have that experience? Because if you don't, I am going on to atheism.
Okay. One of our favorite subjects.
Yeah, that we talk when people aren't calling. Yeah. I was thinking about this. And maybe some atheists and theists could answer this. Did you see this alternate? It's called 9 Questions That Atheists Might Find Insulting and the Answers.
I did not see this.
All right. And actually, I don't find these insulting at all. I think these are very, very good questions. How can you be moral without believing in God? Don't answer.
Fine.
Okay. All right. Here's another one. How do you have any meaning in your life if you don't believe in God? Don't you feel sad or hopeless? Or even if you don't believe in God or heaven, why don't you just kill yourself?
Wow.
That's pretty harsh. Pretty harsh, yeah. Number 3, doesn't it take just as much, even more faith to be an atheist as it does to be a believer? And here the answer is no. Isn't atheism just a religion? No. Why would it be insulted? What atheist would be insulted?
I'm not insulted.
Yeah. What's the point of atheist groups? How can you have a community and a movement for something you don't believe in? I like that one.
Well, we really don't have a group.
Well, there are like groups like Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Oh, well, sure.
And they do a lot of legal work trying to stop the intrusion.
Well, the separation of church and state is strictly
They want to stop the intrusion of religion into the public square where it doesn't belong constitutionally.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Like on is that Alabama, Peter? They tried to put it on the courthouse, the state.
Sometimes they allow it. It's weird. Sometimes they just say it's historical. But most of these places, if they have, and usually they're Christian, and people can now, in a lot of these places, well, remember we were talking about there was this atheist monument somewhere in Florida, wasn't it?
I think so.
Where they had put the Ten Commandments. So you can have that, and you could have, I don't know, something for other religions as well.
Just be one monument after another.
Anybody ever said this to you? This is what we're talking about here. 9 questions that atheists might find insulting. We didn't find any of these insulting. Why do you hate God? Or
how can you hate something you don't believe in?
Well, that's what they say. Atheists aren't angry at God. We don't think God exists. We aren't angry at God any more than we're angry at Santa Claus. This must be so weird to people if you're not down with this. I'm sorry if I'm insulting anybody. But have you read the Bible or any other holy book, heard from someone, heard about some supposed miracle, heard my story about my personal religious experience? Well, there is these books out. Weren't we talking about the other week, Proof of Heaven?
Yeah.
The best-selling combined print and e-book.
New York Times.
New York Times book that this, what was the guy? I can't remember. Some doctor went under and somehow or other came out with Proof of Heaven. Let's see. What if you're wrong?
I always say, well, then go ahead and pray for me.
Yeah. Well, doesn't it make logical sense to believe in God? If you believe and you're wrong, nothing terrible happens. But if you don't believe and you're wrong, dun, 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 dun. You go to hell. And that's called, I think, is this called Occam's Razor? I think that, Pascal's Wager. Well, it was close.
Wow. Whoa.
I'll have to look up Occam's. Yeah, there is something called OCCAM.
Okay, so that wasn't from outer space.
This is, Pascal's Wager. The idea, that's the idea. If you're, might as well bet on the side where you've got
Of safety.
Like,
did you say that?
Err on the side of caution.
Right.
And here is the last one. Why are you atheists so angry?
Oh, we are. So I'm so angry all the time. Can't you tell? Jerry wrote in, we were talking about, this kind of ties into to this, about Grand Rapids and the homeless guys who were arrested for quote-unquote panhandling. He said he thinks the real irony is in Grand Rapids seems to be like going in through a wormhole and ending up in the Bible Belt with a church on every corner, yet they are so willing to dehumanize people in need.
What? Oh, this is this whack job again that just wrote us.
Okay, well, carry on.
We're not going to do that. So, actually, the author of this article, it was on alternate.org. Let me see. Oh, Greta Christina is her name. She has two first names.
I like people with two first names.
Like what? Bob Frank?
Yes. Why? I like it.
Yeah, I like that. What else? Bill Daniels? Nine questions that atheists might find insulting, and the answers. Why are atheists so angry? The answer, she says, I've actually written an entire book answering this question, and her book is called Why Are You Atheists So Angry? 99 Things That Piss Off the Goddess. The Godless.
The God.
I read this wrong.
Strike that.
Yeah.
So, Peter, I want to hear about this interview that's coming up at 1 o'clock with Lenny Sinclair.
Very, very good.
Are you going to run that one first?
Lenny Sinclair was one time married to John Sinclair, one of the more important figures in Detroit rock and roll and jazz as well, who is still active.
And drug laws.
And drug laws, right. He actually, when he was sentenced 9.5 to 10 years for possession of marijuana back in the late 1960s.
Two joints.
Two joints of marijuana.
John Lennon came to town and threw a concert for him, and guess what? All of a sudden, 2 days later, he was out.
Yeah, and who was there? I don't know if I can remember. John Lennon?
Seeger was there.
Bob Seeger? Stevie Wonder?
Yeah, that one.
A lot of incredible folks. That's all online, by the way. In fact, I think some of it is on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Anyway, so Lenny Sinclair has just put out a book along with Gary Grimshaw, a great poster artist who is still active today and did posters for the old Grandy Ballroom that are now, in fact, in the interview, I said some of these original posters that Gary did are worth like $100. She said, Peter, one just sold for $1,200.
Oh, my gosh.
In her book, which is, I think it's called Detroit Rocks, and the history of Detroit rock and roll from 1965 to 1975, they show a little store they had where they're selling Gary's posters for 75 cents.
No kidding. Yeah. My gosh.
One thing I advise people, hold on to everything. Everybody else has thrown it away.
I don't hold on to a dang thing.
Neither do I.
All right. So you're giving the advice to everyone else.
Well, yeah, then it'll be worth something. Okay. Hey, Jefferson, thank you so much for
doing
the phone.
Thank you, Jefferson.
Appreciate it.
And someone called at the last minute. Sorry, we have to get to our commercial break unless you want to.
Can't do it.
Okay.
Next week. All right. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Dave and Chuck the Freak Mornings. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you, Greg. Let's try that one.
Who am I?
Yeah, all right. Here, we need a little bit more time on this. Is that right? Yeah, okay. So, how do I get the track two of this? Okay. Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, Bob Seger in his concert, I think it was the one at Cobo Hall, he said, Detroit, the home of rock and roll. And think about how many great bands have come out of this city. It's just absolutely amazing. What a rich history we have here. And it's been chronicled in an incredibly beautiful, well-done book that takes in every aspect of early rock and roll in Detroit. It's called Detroit Rocks, A Pictorial History of Motor City Rock and Roll 1965 to 1975. And the people that put it together are Gary Grimshaw, the amazing poster artist who did so many posters for the Grandy Ballroom and other places as well and continues to work, and also Lenny Sinclair, a photographer whose wonderful photographs illustrate this book. And it's a pleasure to have Lenny Sinclair in the studio with me, an old friend. Lenny, this is just an amazing book, an absolutely amazing book.
Well, thank you, Peter. I sure appreciate it, and I really appreciate your insight and why this book is so important, because a lot of people will just pick it up and look at all the pretty pictures and posters but not read the text
that I wrote. You know, that's interesting. You wrote the text, and the photographs, most of the photographs are yours. And yet, you wrote me that. You said that when we were setting this up, you said some people weren't even reading the text. And I got the hardbound, the limited edition hardbound cover, quite a few months ago. So I said, boy, I better reread. I better reread this. And so I did. And I would indeed suggest looking at it. Well, maybe we could get at it this way, because your personal history, of course, you were there to chronicle all this with the photographs. Gary Grimshaw, your co-editor of this, was also there doing a lot of the posters that are in the book. This was an extraordinary story. You came from East Germany, communist East Germany, when you were 18 years old. Give me an idea of the circumstances, how in the world you wound up in Detroit.
I had relatives in Detroit, and they sponsored me as an immigrant, and I made citizenship after 5 years probation and became a U.S. citizen.
So you weren't one of those people scaling the wall or anything like that?
No, I got out of East Germany before they built the wall. In fact, I was one of the people that they built the wall for. And I was also one of the people who helped tear it down in 1989.
What do you mean you helped tear it down?
I went and borrowed a hammer from my brother-in-law, and I went to the wall, and I knocked some pieces down.
That's amazing. Head. And did you save a couple pieces?
Oh, yes, I did.
Oh,
yes.
That's absolutely incredible. And one of the things...
Well, the reason I say I was one of the people that made the Berlin Wall necessary, because at the time when I escaped, I think it was like 30,000 people left every month. Mm-hmm. They had to stop the drain of their humanity out of the country, you know.
The brightest and the best were leaving, including you. You wound up in Detroit. What year was that? Like in
1959. I spent 1 year in West Germany getting ready to come here.
And so how did you, as an immigrant who I assume whose English was rather limited, how did you wind up being in the midst of this incredible Detroit rock and roll scene that you chronicle in Detroit Rocks, A Pictorial History of Motor City Rock and Roll?
Well, a lot had to do with meeting my husband back then, John Sinclair. When I first met him, I was going to Wayne State University, and I was studying geography. Not knowing really, I didn't really have any career goals except to get a degree, maybe go on to graduate school and maybe teach. But then I met John Sinclair, and my life took a different turn. We started this organization called the Detroit Artist Workshop, which was like an artist commune, an artist community. And for 2 years, we were super active, putting out books and magazines and corresponding with poets and writers all over the country. And we hosted avant-garde jazz musicians in Detroit. And we had bands that we sent to Toronto, New York, or Chicago, spreading Detroit music around. Well, that lasted about 2 years. And then John went to jail for the first time. And when he got out, he went to DeHoco, the Detroit House of Corrections.
That was for possession
in 1966.
That was for possession of marijuana.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And that was the first time. We'll get into the second time.
Yes. And then after he got out, the whole world seemed to have changed overnight. There was the Summer of Love. There was this phenomenon called hippies. And there were hordes of young people from the suburbs in Detroit coming into Detroit and looking where it's at. Where's it at? Like they've seen the pictures on TV. They read about it in Life magazine. So the hippies gravitated to the Detroit Artists Workshop because, you know, the Summer of Love and the San Francisco scene was started by the local beatniks there,
that,
you know, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and the Bikers.
And the Summer of Love was 1967, and there was also what they would call love-ins. And in Detroit style, I know that your husband at the time, John Sinclair, who we've had as a guest any number of times on this program, he was part of the group that sponsored a Belle Isle love-in that in typical Detroit style had a non-love-in ending, right?
Well, yes. We had a beautiful love-in. We mimicked things that were going on in San Francisco, including the Grandy Ballroom, the light shows, the poster art. And so we heard about the love-in in San Francisco, so we wanted one in Detroit. Our whole thing since starting the Artist Workshop has always been to make it exciting enough in Detroit so people didn't have the desire to leave for the East Coast or the West Coast, you know. And so the love-in was our attempt to have the same thing happening here. And it was beautiful until late in the afternoon, there was an altercation with a biker, and the police used that as an excuse to break up the peaceful festivities, and people ran across a bridge, and some people got so mad they smashed in windows, and then the Free Press or the news had a big headline, "Love Turns to Hate."
Wow. Yeah. Well,
and we thought, oh, this was the end. We're all going to get arrested for this one.
Well, the Fifth Estate newspaper that back then was either a biweekly or weekly chronicled all this and, of course, gave a much different account than the Detroit Free Press. The Fifth Estate almost reaching its 50th anniversary. You can go to fifthestate.org. My guest is Lenny Sinclair. She and poster artist Gary Grimshaw have written Detroit Rocks, a pictorial history of Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 1975. And Lenny was an integral part of it, making so much of it happen, jazz and blues festivals, rock and roll at the Grandy. And the book itself has so many of her wonderful photographs. Yeah, you know, in so many ways, Lenny, I'm so indebted to you that the Fifth Estate, which I worked with, and still do, by the way, that has history in it. But I never saved anything. When we would have Gary Grimshaw posters, now originals that are selling for hundreds of dollars.
Thousands, no.
Thousands? Mm-hmm. And he probably would, if I would have said, sign it, Gary, he would have done it in a heartbeat, probably wondering why I would want him to sign it, but at the time. But my wife would say, hey, isn't this last week's poster? And we'd say, oh, yeah, toss. And collectors can be thankful because if everybody hung on to them instead of being worth thousands, they would be like, tell us about one of the photographs where you, in an office where it has a lot of his posters.
There was a Translove store that we had in a building that's still there today on 2nd and 4th.
Oh, yeah, in the Wayne State area.
Yeah, and we had a little store in front where we sold all the things we made, the buttons, the bumper stickers, the strobe candles, leather goods. You know, we always made things to sell along with underground newspapers and avant-garde jazz records and old posters. You know, the posters, the concert has passed. We had a few left. The sign on the wall says 75 cents.
75 cents for
and,
now.
And I heard recently one of Gary Grimshaw's, his first poster for the Grandy Ballroom, the famous seagull image, sold for $11,000.
Oh, that's incredible.
And Gary does not get a penny of that. He has no originals left. No.
Oh, oh.
No,
okay.
No.
Yeah.
It's like the art world, you know. Once you own something and it goes up in value, you cash in. You know?
Now, there was, and I have it here, I'm just so thankful to you, that I was able to get a first edition hardbound cover of Detroit Rock's pictorial history of Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 75. But now you're out with a soft cover one as well that is available to the public. And right now, it's Amazon.com is where you can...
Right.
And I wasn't quite clear. You said before the show that be careful that you don't wind up with another book. Was that...
When you Google it, the first book that comes up is Steve Miller's book called Detroit Rock City.
Okay.
You can buy that, too. It's quite interesting. It's a little gossipy, but if you know those people he's talking about, it's really interesting reading. But our book comes up, I think, in third place, Detroit Rocks by Gary Grimshaw and Lenny Sinclair. Also, if you Google Lenny Sinclair... Not Google, I mean on Amazon. If you type in Lenny Sinclair or Gary Grimshaw, our book will come up.
And Lenny is L-E-N-I. And I haven't thought about this in years, but that's short for Magdalena, right?
Yeah, for yeah. Magdalene.
Magdalene, okay, all right. And let's talk about the book a little.
Let's talk about how
okay.
how you got how you came into possession of a hardcover first edition publisher's edition copy.
I am one of the publishers.
Right.
Yeah.
This book was made possible by Peter Wilby and about 250 other people who prepaid $100 to help us produce this book. It took us a long time. We thought we would have it out in 2009. Our first flyers is coming in 2009. We thought it would take us 1 year to make it. But then Gary got very ill as soon as we started working on it, and he's been very sick ever since, and only staying alive due to the incredible work his wife does to feed him every day and keep him alive.
Yeah.
But anyway, then we applied for a grant and for a Kresge Arts grant, and both of us got rejection letters, and then... We should have stopped right there, but we decided we're going to go ahead and ask people, our friends and family and fans, people that had bought things from us in the past. They all got a letter soliciting $100 if they wanted to get a copy. It took us 3 years, but it finally saw the light of day, and we got it printed by Thompson Shaw and Dexter. We did not send it out to China to get printed. And after we made the contract, we find out that Thompson Shaw is an employee-owned company.
Oh, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
And since the book is a co-publisher's produced company, I tell people this whole book was produced on the socialist economic model.
Uh-oh.
Because it was all a cooperative.
Right.
By ourselves, we could never have done anything like that.
Well, I just opened this randomly.
And the printer that just an enormously beautiful job. Thompson Shaw, if anybody ever wants to get their own book published, I recommend them because they just do beautiful work.
I would second that as well. Some people might say $100 for a book. No problem whatsoever. It's a glossy print. And like I say, the contents of this are extraordinary. Lenny wrote so much of it, and the text, and then there are all these posters, and I mean, you could be 58 or 68 and listening to this and saying, well, I got to get this book from Amazon.com because it'll bring back all these memories. But if you're 18, for instance, and you know, this covers Detroit Rock and Roll 1965 to 1975, this is could be like ancient history to you, but every bit of this connects with the music of today. And as I say, it's extraordinary. We're mentioning the Fifth Estate before. I just opened up a page to the Artist Workshop Press at 4863 John Lodge down by Wayne State University. And it mentions the Fifth Estate. And it says Detroit's underground newspaper. 1 year, 26 issues, $2.50. Right now, a single copy costs $4. So if you're 18, it probably does sound pretty much from another era, which it is. But, you know, knowing this history. And the first artist workshop at 1252 West Forest, which is now Freedom Place, where they have all these condos and all that. Wasn't that house that Flyers, what was that guy that went across the Lindbergh? Wasn't that Lindbergh's house?
Oh, God. I vaguely remember
I think so.
Like
it is, Charles Lindbergh, sorry. I mean,
but I haven't thought about that in about 40 years.
Well, I think it was. And, of course, they just took it all down. Tell us some, I keep thumbing through this thinking I have to mention this, I have to mention that. I mean, you've got to see the book, folks.
There's even a picture of Harvey Olshinsky, your publisher.
The founder.
Founder,
oh, there he is.
Fifth Estate.
I just got
with his dog.
With Buffy, named after Buffy St. Bernard is what he called it after the singer-songwriter Buffy St. Marie. I don't know if you need a copy, but are there favorites? I mean, what, you know, if you just had a little time and somebody wasn't going to get the book, which they should, what would you say? Hey, look at this one. What would stand out and say in Gary's posters and your photographs of that era?
Actually, it would be a photo of myself.
I bet I know which one.
With the Honorable Judge Damon Keith.
Oh, that's not the one I was going to think of, but tell us about that. Federal Judge, District Judge, Damon Keith.
Well, this is something that I think people ignore when they look through the book. They don't read the last chapter. They never get to the last chapter. But the last chapter is really the main reason I put so much time and energy and effort and blood, sweat, and tears, and Gary Grimshaw too, into making this, because this book, as far as I know, is the first book that ever tells the truth about Watergate and why Watergate happened and what we had to do with it and what the White Panther Party had to do with Nixon resigning and also with the FISA Act. Now with the revelations of Edgar Snowden about the NSA, all this stuff becomes even more relevant, because in 1972, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the government does not have a right to wiretap or break into people's houses without a warrant. What Nixon was trying to do is to cut out the judiciary of the process and say, because in the interest of national security, we can wiretap whoever we want with no oversight. Out of that decision came the FISA Act by Jimmy Carter. Now, if you want to read more about it, buy the book. Go to Amazon.com and buy the book, and I can't read the whole chapter now.
Well, we got to give a little summation. Yeah.
But when you listen to interviews with Damon Keith, who's now a judge in the Federal Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, the court right under the Supreme Court, when you listen to him talking to reporters and they ask him, what is your most important case, he will say the Sinclair case.
Yeah.
Because he was the one judge who stood up against the Nixon administration when they were trying to get more power than the Constitution.
Letty Sinclair is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and she and Gary Grimshaw have put together this incredible book, Detroit Rocks, A Pictorial History of Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 75. And it's available at Amazon.com. Be sure that you when you look for it, you're looking for Detroit Rocks. That's the lead name of it. I thought you were going to say, that's very interesting that you said that was your favorite, because I thought you were going to say the one with your husband at the time, John Sinclair, and John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And John Sinclair was given 9.5 to 10 years in prison for possession of marijuana, his second conviction for possession. And there was this incredible rally at the University of Michigan in Chrysler Arena, wasn't it?
Yes, Chrysler.
And when you look, I mean, John and Lenny could put together these shows that were just astounding, that would have, like, in Ann Arbor later, Miles Davis and John Lee Hooker, or at the fairgrounds with Chuck Berry and Sun Ra. I mean, this is astounding. No one could even afford to do that anymore. I mean, individual performers command so much money. But there was a Free John movement, because John was in jail for the longest time, and there was a rally at Chrysler. I should remember all this. 1971, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And December 10th.
December 10th. And John Lennon and Yoko Ono agreed to appear. Bob Seger, Stevie Wonder, Allen Ginsberg, Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers, the MC5, of course. John was the manager of. And
actually the MC5 did not play on it. They upplayed.
Okay.
Instead,
I was a correspondent for WABX Radio, calling in reports from that rally.
Wasn't that broadcast live?
Yeah.
Over ABX.
Yeah. And I gave a little. I was local color or something like that. But there is a lot about the MC5 in here, though, of course. And all these, you know, let me ask you a question. People, when they say, well, when you, Peter, when they say to me, when you saw Jimi Hendrix or when you saw the Jefferson Airplane, you know, did you think this or that? And I said, we knew it was great music and we loved it and we were part of it. And these were not bands that were distant, but they were part of, like, our community and our larger community. But we didn't have any idea this was going to be this historic epic. Did you have any sense of that?
I must have, because I saved everything.
I know.
I must have thought that was important. Maybe it was egomaniac, and I thought it was important because I was in it. But I saved so much stuff that when John and I separated, we donated our archive to the Bentley Museum, the Michigan Historical Museum.
Right.
And it's known as the John and Lenny Sinclair Papers. And scholars come from all around to study the 60s by looking through the stuff I saved.
Boy, I just looked at the clock. We've got about 3 minutes left. Of course,
oh,
I mean, this is something from an era so exciting and a book so incredible, Detroit Rocks, A Pictorial History of Motor City Rock and Roll by Gary Grimshaw and Lenny Sinclair. A final question, because we have, you know, a little bit of time left. Tell us just quickly, you met after John Lennon appeared in Ann Arbor in 1971, and then, like, 2 days later, John is released from Jackson Prison, and then you met with the two of them in their apartment. You and John met with them in their apartment in New York.
Yeah, Bank Street in New York,
yeah.
Basement apartment. That's where that picture was taken by their in-house photographer at the time, was Robert Agriopoulos, and he let me use that picture in the book.
Yeah.
But can I just mention,
sure,
locally the book is available at a couple stores. One, the BookBeat has a few copies, and Melodies and Memories on Gratiot has a few copies, and People's Records. If there are other stores who want copies to sell, well, they can
contact me. You can contact me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Are you asking for a commission?
not at all. Is it possible, and I should have asked you this before, the paperback edition had some funding behind it. Is that possible to say on the air, or is it?
I think it is, because he gave me permission to mention it in the press release, you know. And he's not ashamed to be part of this. In fact, he feels like you. This is an important document, and he supports it. And he, fortunately, is in a position to support it. It's Mike Potter, the owner of Eden's Foods, who started in Ann Arbor in the 60s and expanded. He's a very good businessman and responsible for the good health of millions.
Well, I don't want to. He is. I keep looking for superlatives to describe this beautiful book that chronicles the history of Detroit rock and roll for a decade, where literally put Detroit on the map for this genre of music. The book is Detroit Rocks, a pictorial history of Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 1975. So much art and posters and the like by Gary Grimshaw, and text by Lenny Sinclair, and also her photographs of the era. And she's been my guest. So, Lenny, thank you so much for being on the broadcast.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a worldwide web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code, and that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
Hi, I'm calling about the two-bedroom apartment you advertised. Is it still available?
Sure.
Great.
Unless you're black or Latino or disabled.
Housing discrimination is rarely this obvious, but it's just as real and just as illegal. So if you hear things like,
I can't assign you a handicapped parking space,
that could be housing discrimination. The only way to stop it is to report it so we can investigate it. Visit hud.gov/fairhousing or call HUD's housing discrimination hotline at 1-800-669-9777. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, there certainly has been a lot in the news lately about the National Security Agency surveillance, and it more and more comes out on it every day. We're being spied on, and it's an odd conglomeration of support and opposition to it. On both ends of it, it's conservatives and liberals. Conservatives and liberals say that the government is too intrusive, and another band of conservatives and liberals say, no, we have to do this to keep ourselves secure. And we're just at a point where we've learned that Al-Qaeda, according to the government, that has plans for some spectacular attack on American embassies and consulates, and a lot of them are shut down even as we speak. So what's this all about? This is nothing new in some regard, because governments have always spied on their people. But I think a book more than worth looking at, because it is so informative, is Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power. How do we link in corporate power to government surveillance and public resistance? It's written by Heidi Boghossian, and it's a foreword by Lewis Lapham. And Heidi Boghossian is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. That's a progressive bar association that goes back to the late 1930s, and it's an alternative to the American Bar Association. She co-hosts the weekly Civil Liberties radio program, Law and Disorder, which is co-hosted by a good friend of mine, this full disclosure, Michael Smith, and it airs on Pacifica's WBAI, and it's got 50 national affiliate stations around the country. She also was the former editor of the independent community newspaper, the East Villager, and we're reaching her at the National Lawyers Guild office in Manhattan. Heidi Boghossian, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's wonderful to be here.
Now, this is interesting because this is published by a wonderful publisher, City Lights Publishers in San Francisco. It says rushing to print. Now, you put this out sooner than you intended, right?
Yes, it was supposed to come out in September, and then, lo and behold, Edward Snowden came on the scene, and we realized how important it would be to try to get it out sooner. And as you said, every day things are changing, and it's really hard to keep up with revelations and things about the government that a lot of people might not have been aware of.
That's interesting, because there's been a lot of shock about it, but I was looking up a quote from Pierre Proudhon, who said in the 1840s, to be governed is to be watched, inspected, spied upon, and then he goes on with a whole list. So government spying on people, particularly its opponents or people it designates as opponents, is nothing new.
You're absolutely right. It's nothing new. Also, the fact that government partners widely with private industry and corporations is not really new. People may know that the Pinkerton Detective Agency in this country was performing a lot of functions that the government has traditionally formed in terms of Crime Watch and law enforcement. And I think that we also see waves of social change in the country when there's a crisis, for example, the attacks of 9/11, the government traditionally constricts civil liberties and says that is necessary to do when the country's safety is at stake. And I think the difficulty we are presented with now is that so many people were terrified and felt vulnerable as a population after 9/11, that when the government passed very hastily drafted legislation, such as the USA Patriot Act, which really chiseled away at our civil liberties and our privacy rights, people fed into that notion that we have to give up certain civil liberties to be safe. And many of us believe that's absolutely not true, that you can strike a balance between First Amendment rights to speak freely about things, to disagree with the government, even when the country is going through difficult times. And I think what we've seen with Edward Snowden is some of the things about how the government farms out, for example, approximately 70% of its intelligence gathering to military contractors and other businesses. One of the problems with that is that those companies are not beholden to the U.S. Constitution, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures by government entities, not by business. So we have a snug relationship between the public and private sectors, and in fact, a big business has made with their technology their own intelligence departments. They're very concerned about protecting the images of large corporations, so that when you get activists, for example, proponents of animal rights, environmental rights activists, criticizing certain corporations, well, they monitor those activists and they keep files on them, and often they share them with the government. So there's a give and take that a lot of people are unaware of our private information. And it's not just the activists, it's any consumer, anyone who does business with a credit card or uses a smartphone. All that data is being gathered, aggregated, and in many cases resold to third parties.
Well, I think everybody would agree that that is contrary to both our constitutional rights and the functioning of democracy. We people in power always need opposition. But you know, there's two aspects here. If we go back into American history, certainly the things like Lincoln suspending habeas corpus, the kind of just awful civil liberties record of the Wilson administration during World War I, the concentration camps for Japanese under the Roosevelt administration. The FBI, the Hoover's role against in the 50s and 60s against civil rights and anti-war activists. There's a number of things going on there. I mean, a lot of times it's been because the government did not want internal opposition to its policies. At other times, though, it's because we were at war, like the Civil War, like the First World War, for whatever. You know, that was used both, that was certainly used to repress internal opposition. And as awful as the concentration camps were for the Japanese, again, this was, you know, it was a war situation. And now, there are people out there that mean us harm. So, can we differentiate between where the government's targets?
That's an excellent point. There is a difference between the targeting that we used to do as a country of certain enemies, and what we see now, which is really almost a public relations campaign, the so-called war on terror. It's almost a war against certain ideologies, people from certain countries, or with certain religious beliefs. It's not going to be a war that has an end in sight. And when you have a war against ideas, the enemy becomes very difficult to pinpoint, and thus it seeps into the domestic way of life, as well as really considering even our foreign allies as potentially enemies to us, which does a lot of harm in terms of trust in foreign relation operations, and also creates an environment where everyone, knowing they're under surveillance, knowing, for example, this X-Keyscore program, the NSA tool that collects nearly everything a user does on the Internet, when you know that you're being constantly monitored, it tends to change the way you speak, even think, conduct, you know, relationships with friends and colleagues. And that is very dangerous to a democracy because it discourages people from thinking outside the box. I mean, President Obama even has a program that he enlisted a couple of years ago for government, federal government employees. If they see or suspect a colleague of doing something suspicious, one of those vague terms that we've heard a lot of over the last few years, they're supposed to turn them in. And one of the dangers of that, especially when you're talking about high level or even just ordinary government workers who are charged with coming up with plans to perhaps keep us safer, is that it discourages creative thinking or thinking outside the box to come up with solutions and ideas to solve complex problems, because people then become afraid of saying something that they think may be perceived as too radical or different. So what we're seeing is really a government that is increasingly shrouding itself in privacy, making more documents than ever classified, refusing to give any kind of transparency to the FISA court, for example, or to these NSA programs, and creating an atmosphere where, for example, an investigative reporter feels perhaps afraid to talk to a confidential source, lawyers feel intimidated and unable to speak freely with clients, especially unpopular clients who the government may be monitoring, because their communications may be listened in on. So it changes the way necessarily we do business when we know we're being spied on. And I think the difference, again, is this is an amorphous fear with really not one identifiable enemy, but we're treating it as really a way of discouraging people from criticizing government and from criticizing the corporations that really run a large part of the world.
You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. My guest is Heidi Boghossian, and she has just published right away because in the wake of these recent exposures. Spying on Democracy is the book. Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance is the name. It's published by City Lights Books. There'll be links to all of this on my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And Heidi Boghossian is also the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Well, yeah, I read earlier this quote from 170 years ago about to be governed is to be watched, inspected, and spied upon. So any critic of the government probably has always assumed, you know, back in the that's all being done with them. Back in the day, this is like in the 60s and all, 1960s, their phones were tapped and their mail was opened and all that. So any critic of the government has to take for granted that they're probably somewhat in the crosshairs of the authorities. And if anyone who said, in fact, I just came across somebody who said, I don't want to be on a list. And I'm thinking, list? What do they think? Somebody's writing you down in a pencil? So have things ramped up? I mean, you laid out what happens when there's this panopticon. I mean, that government is literally willing or rather able to get into every aspect of our communication. I mean, is it different than the 1840s or the 1960s because of electronics?
It's exactly different because of technological advancements, which have really, as you know, are changing every day. I mean, I pick up the business papers in the Times and other papers, and you have to read them every day just to keep up with the rapid changes. Obviously, we are building large data centers, or the government is in Utah and other places, with huge computers to store all of the information that they're gathering, and that's one of the concerns, is that it's not just that they may be monitoring metadata and seeing who you talk to, and now apparently I think with X key score sweeping up literal emails and history and seeing more than they're saying they were seeing, but they can store them. Theoretically, 3 years from now, something may change in this country. Some new group of people or issue may become marked terrorist, for example. And we know that animal rights and environmental activists were labeled the top domestic terrorism threat in 2005. Well, you may find that another group gets that label, and lo and behold, government agents could decide to go back and look for everyone who fits a certain pattern or who went to a certain store and bought something. So I think that holding data, using it for purposes for which it was not originally gathered, is frightening and is definitely a qualitative shift in how spying and domestic spying has been conducted in this country. And again, another difference is that we've had sort of the communist scare At different points, different groups were considered threats to the government. But now it's everyone. It's every person who is in this country is being swept up in this spying apparatus. And it starts, as I mention in the book, with children who are inculcated from a very early age, as soon as they can watch a TV screen or type a computer key, they're approached by McDonald's or Coca-Cola with very friendly, you know, fantasy ads trying to encourage brand loyalty. So that in the process, unless their parents are watching or unless new laws which are being enacted protect the gathering of personal data, when they sign on to a website and befriend one of these little creatures, a lot of their personal information is being captured so that they can then get advertisements and sort of begin the cycle of breeding, really, new consumers. And I talk about how Disney World children wear a bracelet with an RFID chip embedded in it. And to get through the lines faster, all they have to do is scan it. But on it, it has their age, their name, you know, whether they've paid for what kind of package. Then you walk by Cinderella, and if it's your birthday, she says, "Hi, Jane, happy birthday." But, you know, the RFID chips are in a lot of products. People may not know their clothes may have them in them. And, again, the danger with that is that ultimately the government could track not only where you go but who you associate with, so that if you give a pen with a chip in it to someone who bought the pen, or you bought a pen, you give it to a reporter, there's a record, if they're looking, that you talked with that person. And the danger with metadata is if you have, say, an illness and you go see a certain kind of specialist, a doctor, perhaps a health insurance company could deny you coverage because they realize you might have a condition. So the ways that this information can be used, the danger is that it's being collected on everyone, not just a certain group of people, and that the applications may be insidious, discriminatory, and even criminal down the road.
Hmm. Well, and you lay this all out in your book, Spying on Democracy, published by City Lights Books. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Heidi Boghossian, with your work with the National Lawyers Guild, the political activism that you've been involved in most of your life, same with me, we kind of take this for granted that, again, going back to that quote, that we're being watched, inspected, and spied upon. But I wonder the effect that it's having on our listeners. They and I know the National Lawyers Guild, the American Civil Liberties Union, groups like that, the Electronic Freedom Frontier, whatever that group is, there, like launching lawsuits and all that. If I was a listener, I might think, boy, I better keep my head down. These people have me tracked every second. Are we telling people that they just better look out? They would do better just to be compliant, submissive citizens?
Oh, no, we're not telling them that. We're hoping that the first step is to really educate yourself about the ways in which you can be monitored, and then make a decision about how much of your personal information you feel comfortable having shared and possibly resold. Obviously, there are things people can do, such as get encryption programs when they use the internet. Some of them are difficult to use, only in that you have to be consistent with them and really committed to it. But there are simple things to do. Paying cash is one easy thing that people can do. Don't say anything on the telephone or on your emails that you would not want shared with the government or, say, with your employer. Worst case scenario, thinking that things could come out. But I think what's happened over the last couple of decades is that with advances in technology, Americans especially have become very comfortable using devices that, especially in big urban areas, make daily transactions much easier. You don't think before giving a credit card or entering a store's loyalty card program, for example, where you may get discounts. Well, you have to know that every time you enter a loyalty program, or even when you fill out, for example, a warranty card on a product you've purchased, start to look carefully at the kinds of questions they ask you. When they say how many members in your family, or when they ask for personal information, don't fill it out. Don't fill out anything that you would not want handed over to, say, Axiom, an enormous data aggregator, who's going to use that information to make money to marketers and even the government. So you don't have to give out your Social Security number on all the forms that ask for it. Start to be a little prudent about what you share. And then what I encourage people to do, and I have some examples at the back of my book of stories where school children resisted certain programs like a palm reader to get into the cafeteria, or a local community in California that said to city council, we don't want drones in our community that will surveil people, especially if they go to protests, or just watch what we're doing.
Let me interrupt you just because I see the time starting to go away from us, and because there's so much in your book, Spying on Democracy. But one of the aspects of this National Security Agency, NSA surveillance that Edward Snowden leaked was that the programs, the data programs, were to protect us. And just now, I think it was Senator Saxby of Georgia, said that this program allowed us to find out just now that Al-Qaeda was planning a strike against our embassies and consulates. And without it, we would have been subject to attack something like Benghazi. And so you talked about a balance. How do we deal with surveillance against people that actually mean us real harm, and without doing this horrendous total surveillance that you've laid out?
The short answer to that is go back to getting probable cause and going before a neutral magistrate or judge before you get a search warrant. That's not difficult to do. Or if they want to keep the FISA court put in place, someone to oversee and make sure there aren't just blanket stamps on warrants. We need to pull back a little bit, still, of course, engaging in really high-quality intelligence, but we have a lot of duplication of effort. We have a lot of agencies that don't communicate with each other. We formed fusion centers years ago to try to address that. They've been criticized for being ineffective, wasteful. So we need to really get our act together in terms of how our intelligence is collected. And collecting more data does not necessarily equate with doing a better job. In fact, it can be a hindrance. And I'd also like to say these recent claims, the timing of it is very interesting.
Isn't it?
It comes amidst a real sea change in public opinion about the NSA programs. And I don't mean to sound cynical, but the government has done this before, issued, you know, stories, and can interpret things very differently in an effort to really sway public opinion.
Let me get one more thing in, too, before we go. As I said, besides being the National Lawyers Guild Executive Director, Heidi Boghossian is the co-host of Law and Disorder, and her co-host is a good friend of mine, Michael Smith. And apparently, Heidi just told me before, I'm going to be a guest on the show tomorrow to talk about the case of Detroiter Marie Mason. You can go to supportmariemason.org, and we're going to record that tomorrow, I assume, right?
Yes.
Going to be recording? And
yes.
And when will it be broadcast?
It will be broadcast the following Monday, but it will also be podcastable and on our website.
All right. I will have a link there as well. Well, we have only about 60 seconds, and sometimes I ask this, hopeful or not? I mean, most of us, I'm sure, think the surveillance is going to get worse, not better.
Let's be hopeful, because I think once armed with information, the American people have always done the right thing in terms of saying, no, I don't accept this. This is wrong. Our government officials swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. we need to make sure they do that. And I think contacting your legislators, writing pieces for the newspaper, getting together in communities and talking about this can make an enormous difference. So I'm very hopeful.
Well, thank you so much. The book is Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. It's written by my guest, Heidi Boghossian, and it has a foreword by Lewis Lapham. It's available from City Lights Books. There'll be links on my website to all of this. In fact, and as I have said a couple of times, Heidi is also the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. If there's lawyers listening, young law students, check out, isn't it just NLG.org? Is that your?
Yes, NLG.org.
Yeah, and they do incredible work. Okay, we'll talk tomorrow.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Heidi.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
This is your Biotech Minute. Biotechnology, a big word for an area of cutting-edge science that is improving the world we live in. In health, biotech provides breakthrough therapies and treatments for devastating diseases like cancer, MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and HIV/AIDS. Biotechnology is also helping farmers produce more crops from existing acreage, reducing fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions, and it's creating fuels from renewable green energy sources like algae and plant waste. And this is just the beginning. The biotechnology research being done in laboratories today will improve the health and quality of our lives and our world for generations that follow. Biotechnology, helping heal, fuel, and feed the world. A public service message from this station and the Biotechnology Industry Organization.
Take me out to the ball game.
Take me out with the crowd.
I'm a designated driver. It's so darn cool.
I will make sure that we follow the rules, so I'll pledge
no beer, wine, or liquor.
And drive you home safely.
Because it's two tickets to a World Series game.
The reward for responsibility.
Team Coalition thanks you for being a designated driver. Visit RHIR.org.
This Friday, help Lady Jane's Haircuts for Men break the world record for most haircuts given in 12 hours. You'll even score a Lions jersey. Now that's wicked awesome. Be a part of the record and get your free haircut. Register now at WRIF.com. Getting you back to the rock on the Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Carnival of Madness Tour, August 27th, featuring Shinedown and Papa Roach. Learn how you can win free tickets and more. Details at WRIF.com.
what you know about sacrifice. When the